And listen, Jack was down there now. Wolf could smell him. But he also smelled the white man and gunpowder. Careful. Oh, yes, wolves knew careful. Wolves could run and tear and kill, but when they had to be, wolves knew careful. He went down the stairs on all fours, silent as oiled smoke, eyes as red as brake lights. Gardner was becoming steadily more nervous. To Jack, he looked like a man who was entering the freak-out zone. His eyes moved jerkily in a triple play from the studio where Casey was frantically listening to Jack, and then to the closed door which gave on the hall. Most of the noises from upstairs had stopped some time ago. Now Sonny Singer started for the door. "I'll go up and see what's..." "You're not going anywhere. Come back here." Sonny winced, as if Gardner had struck him. "What's the matter, Reverend Gardner?" Jack asked. "You look a little nervous." Sonny rocked him with a slap.
"You ought to watch the way you talk, Snotface. You just ought to watch it."
"You look nervous too, Sonny. And you, Warwick. And Casey in there."
"Shut him up!" Gardner suddenly screamed. "Can't you do anything? Do I have to do everything around here myself?"
Sonny slapped Jack again, much harder. Jack's nose began to bleed, but he smiled. Wolf was very close now, and Wolf was being careful. Jack had begun to have a crazy hope that they might get out of this alive. Casey suddenly straightened up and then tore the cans off his head and flicked the intercom switch.
"Reverend Gardner, I hear sirens on the outside mics."
Gardner's eyes, now too wide, skidded back to Casey.
"What? How many? How far away?"
"Sounds like a lot," Casey said.
"Not close yet, but they're coming here, no doubt about that."
Gardner's nerve broke then. Jack saw it happen. The man sat, indecisive, for a moment, and then he wiped his mouth delicately with the side of his hand. "It isn't whatever happened upstairs. Not just the sirens, either. He knows that Wolf is close, too. In his own way, he smells him, and he doesn't like it. Wolf, we might have a chance. We just might." Gardner handed the pistol to Sonny Singer.
"I haven't time to deal with the police or whatever mess there might be upstairs right now," he said. "The important thing is Morgan Sloat. I'm going to Muncie. You and Andy are coming with me, Sonny. You keep this gun on our friend Jack here while I get the car out of the garage. When you hear the horn, come on out."
"What about Casey?" Andy Warwick rumbled.
"Yes, yes, all right, Casey too," Gardner agreed at once. And Jack thought, "He's running out on you, you stupid assholes. He's running out on you. It's so obvious that he might as well take out a billboard on the Sunset Strip and advertise the fact. And your brains are too blown to even know it. You go on sitting down here for 10 years waiting to hear that horn blow, if the food and toilet paper held out that long."
Gardner got up. Sonny Singer, his face flushed with new importance, sat down behind his desk and pointed the gun at Jack.
"If his retarded friend shows up," Gardner said, "shoot him."
"How could he show up?" Sonny asked. "He's in the box."
"Never mind," Gardner said. "He's evil. They're both evil. It's indubitable. It's axiomatic. If the retard shows up, shoot him. Shoot them both." He fumbled through the keys on his ring and selected one.
"When you hear the horn," he said.
He opened the door and went out. Jack strained his ears for the sound of sirens, but heard nothing. The door closed behind Sunlight Gardner. Time stretching out. A minute that felt like 2. 2 that felt like 10. 4 that felt like an hour. The 3 of Gardner's student aides who had been left with Jack looked like boys who had been caught in a game of statue tag. Sonny sat bolt upright behind Sunlight Gardner's desk, a place he both relished and coveted. The gun pointed steadily at Jack's face. Warwick stood by the door to the hall. Casey sat in the brightly lighted booth with the cans on his ears again, staring blankly out through the other glass square into the darkness of the chapel, seeing nothing, only listening.
"He's not going to take you with him, you know," Jack said suddenly. The sound of his voice surprised him a little. It was even and unafraid.
"Shut up, Snotface," Sonny snapped.
"Don't hold your breath until you hear him honk that horn," Jack said. "You'll turn pretty blue."
"Next thing he says, Andy, break his nose," Sonny said.
That's right, Jack said. Break my nose, Andy. Shoot me, Sonny. The cops are coming. Gardner's gone, and they're going to find the three of you standing over a corpse in a straitjacket. He paused and amended, a corpse in a straitjacket with a broken nose.
Hit him, Andy, Sonny said.
Andy Warwick moved from the door to where Jack sat, straitjacketed, his pants and underpants puddled around his ankles. Jack turned his face openly up to Warwick's.
That's right, Andy, he said. Hit me. I'll hold still. Hell of a target.
Andy Warwick balled up his fist, drew it back, and then hesitated. Uncertainty flickered in his eyes. There was a digital clock on Gardner's desk. Jack's eyes shifted to it for a moment, and then back to Warwick's face.
It's been 4 minutes, Andy. How long does it take a guy to back a car out of the garage, especially when he's in a hurry?
Sonny Singer bolted out of Sunlight Gardner's chair, came around the desk, and charged at Jack. His narrow, secretive face was furious. His fists were balled up. He made as if to hit Jack. Warwick, who was bigger, restrained him. There was trouble on Warwick's face now. Deep trouble.
Wait, he said.
I don't have to listen to this. Why don't you ask Casey how close those sirens are getting, Jack asked.
And Warwick's frown deepened.
You've been left in the lurch. Don't you know that? Do I have to draw you a picture? It's going bad here. He knew it. He smelled it. He's leaving you with a bag.
From the sounds upstairs, Singer broke free of Warwick's half-hearted hold and clouted Jack on the side of the face. His head rocked to one side, then came slowly back.
It's a big, messy bag, Jack finished.
You shut up or I'll kill you, Sonny hissed.
The digits on the clock had changed. 5 minutes now, Jack said.
Sonny, Warwick said with a catch in his voice, let's get him out of that thing.
No!
Sonny's cry was wounded, furious, ultimately frightened.
You know what the Reverend said, Warwick said rapidly, before, when the TV people came. Nobody can see the straitjackets. They wouldn't understand. They click the intercom.
Sonny, Andy, Casey sounded panicky, they're closer. The sirens, Christ, what are we supposed to do?
Let him out now.
Warwick's face was pallid, except for two red spots high on his cheekbones.
Reverend Gardner also said, I don't give a fuck what he also said.
Warwick's voice dropped, and now he voiced the child's deepest fear.
We're gonna get caught, Sonny. We're gonna get caught.
And Jack thought that now he could hear sirens. Or perhaps it was only his imagination. Sonny's eyes rolled toward Jack with horrible, trapped indecision. He half raised the gun, and for one moment Jack believed Sonny was really going to shoot him. But it was 6 minutes now, and still no honk from the Godhead announcing that the Deus Ex Machina was now boarding for Muncie.
You let him loose, Sonny said sulkily to Andy Warwick. I don't even want to touch him. He's a sinner, and he's a queer.
Sonny retreated to the desk as Andy Warwick's fingers fumbled with the straitjacket's lacings.
You better not say anything, he panted. You better not say anything or I'll kill you myself.
Right arm free. Left arm free. They collapsed bonelessly into his lap, pins and needles coming back. Warwick hauled the hateful restraint off him, a horror of dun-colored canvas and rawhide lacings. Warwick looked at it in his hands and grimaced. He darted across the room and began to stuff it into Sunlight Gardner's safe.
Pull up your pants, Sonny said. You think I want to look at your works?
Jack fumbled up his shorts, got the waistband of his pants, dropped them, and managed to pull them up. Click, the intercom.
Sonny, Andy, Casey's voice panicked. I hear something.
Are they turning in?
Sonny almost screamed. Warwick redoubled his efforts to stuff the straitjacket into the safe.
Are they turning in the front? No! In the chapel. I can't see nothing, but I can hear something in there.
There was an explosion of shattering glass as Wolf leaped from the darkness of the chapel and into the studio. Casey's screams, as he pushed back from the control board in his wheel-footed chair, were hideously amplified. Inside the studio, there was a brief storm of glass. Wolf landed four-footed on the slanted control board and half-climbed, half-slid down it, his eyes throwing a red glare. His long claws turned dials and flicked switches at random. The big reel-to-reel Sony tape recorder started to turn.
"Communists!"
the voice of Sunlight Gardner bellowed. He was cranked to maximum volume, drowning out Casey's shrieks and Warwick's screams to shoot it, Sonny, shoot it, shoot it. But the voice of Gardner was not alone. In the background, like music from hell, came the mingled warble of many sirens as Casey's mics picked up a caravan of police cruisers turning into the Sunlight Homes drive.
"Oh, they're gonna tell you it's all right to look at those dirty books. They're gonna tell you it don't matter that it's against the law to pray in the public schools. They're gonna tell you it don't even matter that there are 16 U.S. representatives and 2 U.S. governors who are avowed homosexuals. They're gonna tell you..."
Casey's chair rolled back against the glass wall between the studio and Sunlight Gardner's office. His head turned, and for one moment they could all see his agonized, bulging eyes. Then Wolf leaped from the edge of the control panel. His head struck Casey's gut and plowed into it. His jaws began to open and close with the speed of a cane-cutting machine. Blood flew up and splattered the window as Casey began to convulse.
"Shoot it, Sonny! Shoot the fucking thing!" Warwick whooped.
"Think I'm gonna shoot him instead," Sonny said, looking around at Jack.
He spoke with the air of a man who has finally arrived at a great conclusion. He nodded, began to grin.
"Day is coming, boys. Oh, yes, a mighty day. And on that day, those communist, humanist, hell-bound atheists are gonna find out that the rock will not shield them. The dead tree will not give them shelter. They're gonna, oh, say hallelujah, they're gonna..."
Wolf, snarling and ripping. Sunlight Gardner ranting about communism and humanism, the hellbound dope pushers who wanted to see that prayer never made it back into the public schools. Sirens from outside, slamming car doors, someone telling someone else to take it slow. The kid had sounded scared.
"Yes, you're the one. You made all this trouble."
He raised the .45. The muzzle of the .45 looked as big as the mouth of the Oatley Tunnel. The glass wall between the studio and the office blew inward with a loud, coughing roar. A gray-black, shaggy shape exploded into the room, its muzzle torn nearly in two by a jag of glass, its feet bleeding. It bellowed an almost human sound, and the thought came to Jack so powerfully that it sent him reeling backward.
"You will not harm the herd."
"Wolf!" he wailed. "Look out! Look out! He's got a..." Sonny pulled the trigger of the .45 twice. The reports were deafening in the closed space. The bullets were not aimed at Wolf, they were aimed at Jack. But they tore into Wolf instead, because at that instant he was between the two boys, in mid-leap. Jack saw huge, ragged, bloody holes open in Wolf's side as the bullets exited. The paths of both slugs were deflected as they pulverized Wolf's ribs, and neither touched Jack, although he felt one whiff past his left cheek.
"Wolf!"
Wolf's dexterous, limber leap had turned awkward. His right shoulder rolled forward, and he crashed into the wall, splattering blood and knocking down a framed photograph of Sunlight Gardner in a Shriner's fez. Laughing, Sonny Singer turned toward Wolf and shot him again. He held the gun in both hands, and his shoulders jerked with the recoil. Gun smoke hung in a thick, noxious, unmoving rafter. Wolf struggled up on all fours, and then rose somehow to his feet. A shattering, wounded bellow of pain and rage overtopped Sunlight Gardner's thundering recorded voice. Sonny shot Wolf a fourth time. The slug tore a gaping hole in his left arm. Blood and gristle flew.
"Jackie! Jackie! Oh, Jackie! Hurts! That hurts me!"
Jack shambled forward and grabbed Gardner's digital clock. It was simply the first thing that came to hand.
"Sonny, look out!" Warwick shouted.
"Look!" Then Wolf, his entire midsection, now a gory tangle of blood-matted hair, pounced on him. Warwick grappled with Wolf, and for a moment they appeared almost to be dancing.
in a lake of fire forever, for the Bible says...
Jack brought the digital radio down on Sonny's head with all the force he could muster as Sonny began to turn around. Plastic crunched. The numbers on the front of the clock began to blink randomly. Sonny reeled around, trying to bring the gun up. Jack swung the radio in a flat, rising arc that ended at Sonny's mouth. Sonny's lips flew back in a great funhouse grin. There was a brittle crunch as his teeth broke. His finger jerked the trigger of the gun again. The bullet went between his feet. He hit the wall, rebounded, and grinned at Jack from his bloody mouth. Swaying on his feet, he raised the gun. Hellbound wolf through Warwick. Warwick flew through the air with the greatest of ease and struck Sonny in the back as Sonny fired. The bullet went wild, hitting one of the turning tape reels in the sound studio and pulverizing it. The ranting, screaming voice of Sunlight Gardner ceased. A great bass hum of feedback began to rise from the speakers. Roaring, staggering, Wolf advanced on Sonny Singer. Sonny pointed the .45 at him and pulled the trigger. There was a dry, impotent click. Sonny's wet grin faltered.
"No,"
he said mildly, and pulled the trigger again, and again, and again. As Wolf reached for him, he threw the gun and tried to run around Gardner's big desk. The pistol bounced off Wolf's skull, and with a final, failing burst of strength, Wolf leaped across Sunlight Gardner's desk after Sonny, scattering everything that had been there. Sonny backed away, but Wolf was able to grab his arm.
"No!" Sonny screamed. "No, you better not! You'll go back in the box! I'm a big man around here! I...
Wolf twisted Sonny's arm. There was a ripping sound, the sound of a turkey drumstick being torn from the cooked bird by an overenthusiastic child. Suddenly, Sonny's arm was in Wolf's big front paw. Sonny staggered away, blood jetting from his shoulder. Jack saw a wet, white knob of bone. He turned away and was violently sick. For a moment, the whole world swam into grayness. When he looked around again, Wolf was swaying in the middle of the carnage that had been Gardner's office. His eyes guttered pale yellow, like dying candles. Something was happening to his face, to his arms and legs. He was becoming Wolf again, Jack saw, and then understood fully what that meant. The old legends had lied about how only silver bullets could destroy a werewolf, but apparently about some things they did not lie. Wolf was changing back because he was dying.
"Wolf, no!"
he wailed, and managed to get to his feet. He got halfway to Wolf, slipped in a puddle of blood, went to one knee, got up again.
"No!"
"Jackie."
The voice was low, guttural, little more than a growl, but understandable. And, incredibly, Wolf was trying to smile. Warwick had gotten Gardner's door open. He was backing slowly up the steps, his eyes wide and shocked.
"Go on!" Jack screamed. "Go on! Get out of here!"
Andy Warwick fled like a scared rabbit. A voice from the intercom, Frankie Williams's voice, cut through the droning buzz of feedback. It was horrified, but filled with a terrible, sickly excitement.
"Christ, look at this! Looks like somebody went bullshit with a meat cleaver! Some of you guys check the kitchen!"
"Jackie!"
Wolf collapsed like a falling tree. Jack knelt, turned him over. The hair was melting away from Wolf's cheeks with the eerie speed of time-lapse photography. His eyes had gone hazel again, and to Jack he looked horribly tired.
"Jackie!"
Wolf raised a bloody hand and touched Jack's cheek.
"Shoot you?
Did he know?" Jack said, cradling his friend's head. "No, Wolf, never got me. Never did."
"I..."
Wolf's eyes closed and then opened slowly again. He smiled with incredible sweetness and spoke carefully, enunciating each word, obviously needing to convey this, if nothing else.
"I... kept my herd safe."
"Yes, you did,"
Jack said, and his tears began to flow. They hurt, He cradled Wolf's shaggy, tired head and wept.
You sure did, good old Wolf.
Good old Jackie.
Wolf, I'm going to go upstairs. There are cops. An ambulance?
No.
Wolf once again seemed to rouse himself to a great effort.
Go on. You go on.
Not without you, Wolf.
All the lights had blurred double, treble. He held Wolf's head in his burned hands.
Not without you, huh? No way.
Wolf doesn't want to live in this world.
He pulled a great, shuddering breath into his broad, shattered chest and tried another smile.
Smells too bad.
Wolf, listen, Wolf.
Wolf took his hands gently. As he held them, Jack could feel the hair melting from Wolf's palms. It was a ghostly, terrible sensation.
I love you, Jackie.
I love you too, Wolf, Jack said, right here and now.
Wolf smiled.
Going back, Jackie. I can feel it. Going back.
Suddenly Wolf's very hands felt insubstantial in Jack's grip.
Wolf!
He screamed.
Going back home.
Wolf, no!
He felt his heart stagger and wrench in his chest. It would break. Oh, yes, hearts could break. He felt that.
Wolf, come back! I love you!
There was a sensation of lightness in Wolf now, a feeling that he was turning into something like a milkweed pod, or a shimmer of illusion. A daydream.
Goodbye.
Wolf was fading glass. Fading. Fading.
Wolf!
Love you, Jack.
Wolf was gone. There was only a bloody outline on the floor where he had been.
Oh, God,
Jack moaned.
Oh, God, oh, God.
He hugged himself and began to rock back and forth in the demolished office, moaning. Chapter 27. Jack lights out again. Time passed. Jack had no idea how much or how little. He sat with his arms wrapped around himself as if he were in the straitjacket again, rocking back and forth, moaning, wondering if Wolf could really be gone. He's gone. Oh, yes, he's gone. And guess who killed him, Jack? Guess who? At some point, the feedback hum took on a rasping note. A moment later, there was a high-gain crackle of static, and everything shorted out. Feedback hum, upstairs chatter, idling engines out front. Jack barely noticed.
Go on. Wolf said to go on. I can't. I'm tired. And whatever I do is the wrong thing. People get killed. Quit it, you self-pitying jerk. Think about your mother, Jack. No, I'm tired. Let me be.
And the Queen.
Please, just leave me alone.
At last he heard the door at the top of the stairs open, and that roused him. He did not want to be found here. Let them take him outside, in the backyard, but not in this stinking, blood-spattered, smoky room where he had been tortured and his friend killed. Barely thinking about what he was doing, Jack took up the envelope with Jack Parker written across the front. He looked inside and saw the guitar pick, the silver dollar, his beat-up wallet, the Rand McNally Road Atlas. He tilted the envelope and saw the marble. He stuck everything in the pack and slipped it on, feeling like a boy in a state of hypnosis. Footfalls on the stairs, slow and cautious. Where's the damn lights? Funny smell, like a zoo. Watch it, boys. Jack's eyes happened on the steel file tray, neatly stacked with envelopes reading, I'll be a sunbeam for Jesus. He helped himself to two of them. Now when they grab you coming out, they can get you for robbery as well as murder. Didn't matter. He was moving now for the simple sake of movement, no more than that. The backyard appeared completely deserted. Jack stood at the top of the stairs that exited through a bulkhead and looked around, hardly able to believe it. There were voices from the front, and pulses of light, and occasional smears of static and dispatchers' voices from police radios that had been cranked up all the way to high gain. But the backyard was empty. It made no sense. But he supposed if they were confused enough, rattled enough by what they had found inside... Then a voice, muffled, less than 20 feet away on Jack's left, said, "Christ, do you believe this?" Jack's head snapped around. There, squatting on the beaten dirt like a crude Iron Age coffin, was the box. A flashlight was moving around inside. Jack could see shoe soles sticking out. A dim figure was crouching by the mouth of the box, examining the door. "Looks like this thing was ripped right off in its hinges," the fellow looking at the door called into the box. "I don't know how anyone could have done it, though. Hinges are steel, but they're just twisted." "Never mind the damn hinges," the muffled voice came back. "This goddamn thing, they kept kids in here, Paulie. I really think they did. Kids. There's initials on the walls." The light moved. "And Bible verses." The light moved again. "And pictures. Little pictures. Little stick men and women like kids draw. Christ, do you think Williams knew about this?"
"Must have," Paulie said, still examining the torn and twisted steel hinges on the box's door. Paulie was bending in, his colleague was backing out. Making no special attempt at concealment, Jack walked across the open dooryard behind them. He went along the side of the garage and came out on the shoulder of the road. From here he had an angle on the careless jam of police cars in the Sunlight Home's front yard. As Jack stood watching, an ambulance came tearing up the road, flashers whirling, siren warbling.
"Loved you, Wolf," Jack muttered, and wiped an arm across his wet eyes. He set off down the road into darkness, thinking he would most likely be picked up before he got a mile west of the Sunlight Home. But 3 hours later, he was still walking. Apparently the cops had more than enough to occupy them back there. There was a highway up ahead, over the next rise or the rise after that. Jack could see the orangey glow of high-intensity sodium arcs on the horizon, could hear the whine of the big rigs. He stopped in a trash-littered ravine and washed his face and hands in the trickle of water coming out of a culvert. The water was almost paralyzing cold, but at least it silenced the throbbing in his hands for a while. The old cautions were coming back almost unbidden. Jack stood for a moment where he was, under the dark night sky of Indiana, listening to the whine of the big trucks. The wind, murmuring in the trees, lifted his hair. His heart was heavy with the loss of Wolf, but even that could not change how good, how very good it was to be free. An hour later, a trucker slowed for the tired, pallid boy standing in the breakdown lane with his thumb cocked. Jack climbed in.
"Where are you headed, kiddo?" the trucker asked.
Jack was too tired and too sick at heart to bother with the story. He barely remembered it anyway. He supposed it would come back to him. "West," he said. "Far as you're going."
"That'd be mid-state."
"Fine," Jack said, and fell asleep. The big diamond Rio rolled through the chilly Indiana night. Charlie Daniels on the tape player, it rolled west, chasing its own headlights toward Illinois. Chapter 28. Jack's Dream. Of course, he carried Wolf with him. Wolf had gone home, but a big loyal shadow rode beside Jack in all the trucks and Volkswagen vans and dusty cars pounding along the Illinois highways. This smiling ghost pierced Jack's heart. Sometimes he could almost see Wolf's huge, hairy form bounding alongside, romping through the stripped fields. Free, Wolf beamed at him with pumpkin-colored eyes. When he jerked his eyes away, Jack felt the absence of a wolf hand folding itself around his. Now that he missed his friend so completely, the memory of his impatience with Wolf shamed him, brought the blood to his face. He had thought about abandoning Wolf more times than he could count. Shameful, shameful. Wolf had been... It took Jack a time to take it in, but the word was noble. And this noble being, so out of place in this world, had died for him. I kept my herd safe. Jack Sawyer was the herd no longer. I kept my herd safe. There were times when the truck drivers or insurance salesmen who had picked up this strange, compelling boy on the side of the road, picked him up even though the boy was road dirty and shaggy, even though they might never have taken on a hitchhiker before in their lives, looked over and saw him blinking back tears. Jack mourned Wolf as he sped across Illinois. He had somehow known that he would have no trouble getting rides once in that state, and it was true that often all he had to do was stick out his thumb and look an oncoming driver in the eye. Instant ride. Most of the drivers did not even demand the story. All he had to do was give some minimal explanation for traveling alone. I'm going to see a friend in Springfield. I have to pick up a car and drive it back home. Great, great, the driver said. Had they even heard? Jack could not tell. His mind riffled through a mile-high stack of images of Wolf splashing into a stream to rescue his territory's creatures, Wolf nosing into a fragrant box that had held a hamburger, Wolf pushing food into his shed, bursting into the recording studio, taking the bullets, melting away. Jack did not want to see these things again and again, but he had to, and they made his eyes burn with tears. Not far out of Danville, a short 50-ish man with iron gray hair and the amused but stern expression of one who has taught fifth grade for 2 decades, kept darting sly looks at him from behind the wheel, then finally said, "Aren't you cold, Buster? You ought to have more than that little jacket." "Maybe a little," Jack said. Sunlight Gardner had thought the denim jackets warm enough for field work right through the winter, but now the weather licked and stabbed right through its pores. "I have a coat on the back seat," the man said. "Take it." "No, don't even try to talk your way out of it. That coat's yours now. Believe me, I won't freeze." "But you have no choice at all in the matter. That is now your coat. Try it on." Jack reached over the back of the seat and dragged a heavy length of material onto his lap. At first it was shapeless, anonymous. A big patch pocket surfaced, then a toggle button. It was a Loden coat, fragrant with pipe tobacco. "My old one," the man said. "I just keep it in the car because I don't know what to do with it. Last year the kids gave me this goose down thing. So you have it." Jack struggled into the big coat, putting it on right over the denim jacket. "Oh boy," he said. It was like being embraced by a bear with a taste for Borkum Riff. "Good," the man said. "Now, if you ever find yourself standing out on a cold and windy road again, you can thank Miles P. Kiger of Ogden, Illinois, for saving your skin. Your..." Miles P. Kiger looked as though he were going to say more. The word hung in the air for a second. The man was still smiling. Then the smile warped into goofy embarrassment, and Kiger snapped his head forward. In the gray morning light, Jack saw a mottled red pattern spread out across the man's cheeks. "Your something skin? Oh, no. Your beautiful skin. Your touchable, kissable, adorable..." Jack pushed his hands deep into the Loden coat's pockets and pulled the coat tightly around him. Miles P. Kiger of Ogden, Illinois, stared straight ahead. "Ahem," Kiger said. Exactly like a man in a comic book. "Thanks for the coat," Jack said. "Really, I'll be grateful to you whenever I wear it." "Sure, okay," Kiger said. "Forget it." But for a second his face was oddly like poor Donnie Keegan's back in the Sunlight home. "There's a place up ahead," Kiger said. His voice was choppy, abrupt, full of phony calm. "We can get some lunch if you like." "I don't have any money left," Jack said, a statement exactly $2.38 shy of the truth. "Don't worry about it." Kiger had already snapped on his turn indicator. They drove into a windswept, nearly empty parking lot before a low gray structure that looked like a railway car. A neon sign above the central door flashed Empire Diner. Kiger pulled up before one of the diner's long windows and they left the car. This coat would keep him warm, Jack realized. His chest and arms seemed protected by woolen armor. Jack began to move toward the door under the flashing sign, but turned around when he realized that Kiger was still standing beside the car. The gray-haired man, only an inch or two taller than Jack, was looking at him over the car's top.
"Say," Kiger said.
"Look, I'd be happy to give you your coat back," Jack said.
"No, that's yours now. I was just thinking I'm not really hungry, after all, and if I keep on going, I can make pretty good time, get home a little earlier."
"Sure," Jack said.
"You'll get another ride here. Easy, I promise. I wouldn't drop you here if you were going to be stranded."
"Fine."
"Hold on, I said I'd get you lunch, and I will."
He put his hand in his trouser pocket, then held a bill out across the top of the car to Jack. The chill wind ruffled his hair and flattened it against his forehead.
"Take it."
"No, honest," Jack said. "It's okay. I have a couple of dollars."
"Get yourself a good steak," Kiger said,
and was leaning across the top of the car, holding out the bill as if offering a life preserver, or reaching for one. Jack reluctantly came forward and took the bill from Kiger's extended fingers. It was a 10.
"Thanks a lot.
I mean it."
"Here, why don't you take the paper, too? Have something to read? You know, if you have to wait a little or something?"
Kiger had already opened his door and leaned inside to pluck a folded tabloid newspaper off the back seat.
"I've already read it."
He tossed it over to Jack. The pockets of the Loden coat were so roomy that Jack could slip the folded paper into one of them. Miles P. Kiger stood for a moment beside his open car door, squinting at Jack.
"If you don't mind my saying so, you're going to have an interesting life," he said.
"It's pretty interesting already," Jack said truthfully. Salisbury steak was $5.40, and it came with French fries. Jack sat at the end of the counter and opened the newspaper. The story was on the second page. The day before, he had seen it on the first page of an Indiana newspaper. Arrests made related to shock horror deaths. Local magistrate Ernest Fairchild and police officer Frank B. Williams of Cayuga, Indiana, had been charged with misuse of public monies and acceptance of bribes in the course of the investigation of the deaths of 6 boys at the Sunlight Gardner Scripture Home for Wayward Boys. The popular evangelist Robert Sunlight Gardner had apparently escaped from the grounds of the home shortly before the arrival of the police, and while no warrants had as yet been issued for his arrest, he was urgently being sought for questioning. "Was he another Jim Jones?" asked the caption beneath a picture of Gardner at his most gorgeous, arms outspread, hair falling in perfect waves. Dogs had led the state police to an area near the electrified fences where boys' bodies had been buried without ceremony. 5 bodies, it appeared, most of them so decomposed that identification was not possible. They would probably be able to identify Ferd Janklo. His parents would be able to give him a real burial, all the while wondering what they had done wrong exactly, all the while wondering just how their love for Jesus had condemned their brilliant, rebellious son. When the Salisbury steak came, it tasted both salty and woolly, but Jack ate every scrap and soaked up all the thick gravy with the Empire Diner's underdone fries. He had just about finished his meal when a bearded trucker with a Detroit Tigers cap shoved down over long black hair, a parka that seemed to be made from wolfskins, and a thick cigar in his mouth, paused beside him and asked, "You need a ride west, kid? I'm going to Decatur." "Halfway to Springfield." Just like that. That night, in a $3-a-night hotel the trucker had told him about, Jack had 2 distinct dreams. Or he later remembered these 2 out of many that deluged his bed, or the 2 were actually 1 long joined dream. He had locked his door, peed into the stained and cracked sink in the corner, put his knapsack under his pillow, and fallen asleep holding the big marble that in the other world was a territory's mirror. There had been a suggestion of music, an almost cinematic touch, fiery, alert bebop. At a volume so low, Jack could just pick out that the lead instruments were a trumpet and an alto saxophone. "Richard," Jack drowsily thought. "Tomorrow I should be seeing Richard Sloat," and fell down the slope of the rhythm into brimming unconsciousness. Wolf was trotting toward him across a blasted, smoking landscape. Strings of barbed wire now and then coiling up into fantastic and careless barbed wire intricacies separated them. Deep trenches, too, divided the spoiled land, one of which Wolf vaulted easily before nearly tumbling into one of the ranks of wire. "Watch out," Jack called. Wolf caught himself before falling into the triple strands of wire. He waved one big paw to show Jack that he was unhurt, and then cautiously stepped over the wires. Jack felt an amazing surge of happiness and relief pass through him. Wolf had not died. Wolf would join him again. Wolf made it over the barbed wire and began trotting forward again. The land between Jack and Wolf seemed mysteriously to double in length. Gray smoke hanging over the many trenches almost obscured the big, shaggy figure coming forward. "Jason," Wolf shouted. "Jason, Jason. I'm still here," Jack shouted back. "Can't make it, Jason. Wolf can't make it. Keep trying," Jack bawled. "Damn it, don't give up." Wolf paused before an impenetrable tangle of wire, and through the smoke Jack saw him slip down to all fours and trot back and forth, nosing for an open place. From side to side, Wolf trotted, each time going out a greater distance, with every second becoming more evidently disturbed. Finally, Wolf stood up again and placed his hands on the thick tangle of wire and forced a space he could shout through. "Wolf can't, Jason. Wolf can't. I love you, Wolf," Jack shouted across the smoldering plain. "Jason," Wolf bawled back. "Be careful. They are coming for you. There are more of them." "More what?" Jack wanted to shout but could not. He knew. Then either the whole character of the dream changed, or another dream began. He was back in the ruined recording studio and office at the Sunlight Home, and the smells of gunpowder and burned flesh crowded the air. Singer's mutilated body lay slumped on the floor, and Casey's dead form drooped through the shattered glass panel. Jack sat on the floor, cradling Wolf in his arms, and he knew again that Wolf was dying. Only Wolf was not Wolf. Jack was holding Richard Sloat's trembling body, and it was Richard who was dying. Behind the lenses of his sensible black plastic eyeglasses, Richard's eyes skittered aimlessly, painfully. "Oh no, oh no," Jack breathed out in horror. Richard's arm had been shattered, and his chest was a pulp of ruined flesh and blood-stained white shirt. Fractured bones glinted whitely here and there like teeth. "I don't want to die," Richard said, every word a superhuman effort. "Jason, you should not. You should not have. You can't die too," Jack pleaded. "Not you too." Richard's upper body lurched against Jack's arms, and a long, liquid sound escaped Richard's throat, and then Richard found Jack's eyes with his own suddenly clear and quiet eyes. "Jason." The sound of the name, which was almost appropriate, hung softly in the stinking air. "You killed me," Richard breathed out, "or you kill thee," since his lips could not meet to form one of the letters. Richard's eyes swam out of focus again, and his body seemed to grow instantly heavier in Jack's arms. There was no longer life in that body. Jason DeLoessian stared up in shock. And Jack Sawyer snapped upright in the cold, unfamiliar bed of a flophouse in Decatur, Illinois, and in the yellowish murk shed by a street lamp outside, saw his breath plume out as luxuriantly as if exhaled from 2 mouths at once. He kept himself from screaming only by clasping his hands, his own 2 hands, and squeezing them together hard enough to crack a walnut. Another enormous white feather of air steamed out of his lungs. Richard! Wolf, running across that dead world, calling out, "What?" "Jason." The boy's heart executed a quick, decided leap with the kick of a horse clearing a fence. Chapter 29. Richard at Thayer. At 11 o'clock the next morning, an exhausted Jack Sawyer unshouldered his pack at the end of a long playing field covered with crisp, brown, dead grass. Far away, two men in plaid jackets and baseball caps labored with leaf blower and rake down on the stretch of lawn surrounding the most distant group of buildings. To Jack's left, directly behind the red brick backside of the Thayer Library, was the faculty parking lot. In the front of Thayer School, a great gate opened onto a tree-lined drive, which circled around a large quad crisscrossed with narrow paths. If anything stood out on the campus, it was the library, a Bauhaus steamship of glass and steel and brick. Jack had already seen that a secondary gate opened onto another access road before the library. This ran two-thirds the length of the school and ended at the garbage dumpsters nested in the round cul-de-sac just before the land climbed up to form the plateau of the football field. Jack began to move across the top of the field toward the rear of the classroom buildings. When the Thayerites began to go to dining hall, he could find Richard's room, entry 5, Nelson House. The dry winter grass crunched beneath his feet. Jack pulled Miles P. Kiger's excellent coat tightly about him. The coat, at least, looked preppy if Jack did not. He walked between Thayer Hall and an upper school dormitory named Spence House in the direction of the quad. Lazy pre-luncheon voices came through the Spence House windows. Jack glanced toward the quad and saw an elderly man, slightly stooped and of a greenish bronze, standing on a plinth the height of a carpenter's bench and examining the cover of a heavy book. Elder Thayer, Jack surmised. He was dressed in the stiff collar, flowing tie, and frock coat of a New England Transcendentalist. Elder Thayer's brass head inclined over the volume, pointed generally in the direction of the classroom buildings. Jack took the right angle at the end of the path. Sudden noise erupted from an upstairs window ahead. Boys shouting out the syllables of a name that sounded like Etheridge, Etheridge. Then an eruption of wordless screams and shouts, accompanied by the sounds of heavy furniture moving across a wooden floor. Etheridge! Jack heard a door closing behind his back and looked over his shoulder to see a tall boy with dirty blonde hair rushing down the steps of Spence House. He wore a tweed sport jacket and a tie and a pair of L.L. Bean Maine hunting shoes. Only a long yellow and blue scarf wound several times around his neck protected him from the cold. His long face looked both haggard and arrogant, and just now was the face of a senior in a self-righteous rage. Jack pushed the hood of the Loden coat over his head and moved down the path. "I don't want anybody to move," the tall boy shouted up at the closed window. "You freshmen, just stay put!" Jack drifted toward the next building. "You're moving the chairs!" the tall boy screamed behind him. "I can hear you doing it! Stop!" Then Jack heard the furious senior call out to him. Jack turned around, his heart beating loudly. "Get over to Nelson House right now, whoever you are, on the double, post-haste, immediately, or I'll go to your housemaster." "Yes, sir," Jack said, and quickly turned away to move in the direction the prefect had pointed. "You're at least 7 minutes late!" Etheridge screeched at him, and Jack was startled into jogging. "On the double, I said!" Jack turned the jog into a run. When he started downhill, he hoped it was the right way. It was, anyway, the direction in which Etheridge had seemed to be looking. He saw a long black car, a limousine, just beginning to swing through the main front gates and whisper up the long drive to the quad. He thought that maybe whatever sat behind the tinted windows of the limousine was nothing so ordinary as the parent of a Thayer School sophomore. The long black car eased forward, insolently slow. "No," Jack thought, "I'm spooking myself." Still, he could not move. Jack watched the limousine pull up to the bottom of the quad and stop, its motor running. A black chauffeur with the shoulders of a running back got out of the front seat and opened the rear passenger door. An old white-haired man, a stranger, effortfully got out of the limousine's back seat. He wore a black topcoat which revealed an immaculate white shirt front and a solid dark tie. The man nodded to his chauffeur and began to toil across the quad in the direction of the main building. He never even looked in Jack's direction. The chauffeur elaborately craned his neck and looked upward as if speculating about the possibility of snow. Jack stepped backward and watched while the old man made it to the steps of Thayer Hall. The chauffeur continued his specious examination of the sky. Jack melted backward down the path until the side of the building shielded him, and then he turned around and began to trot. Nelson House was a three-story brick building on the other side of the quadrangle. Two windows on the ground floor showed him a dozen seniors exercising their privileges, reading while sprawled on couches, playing a desultory game of cards on a coffee table. Others stared lazily at what must have been a television set parked beneath the windows. An unseen door slammed shut a little farther up the hill, and Jack caught a glimpse of the tall, blonde senior, Etheridge, stalking back to his own building after dealing with the freshman's crimes. Jack cut across the front of the building, and a gust of cold wind smacked up against him as soon as he reached its side. And around the corner was a narrow door and a plaque, wooden this time, white with gothic black lettering, saying Entry 5. A series of windows stretched down to the next corner. And here, at the third window, relief. For here was Richard Sloat, his eyeglasses firmly hooked around his ears, his necktie knotted, his hands only slightly stained with ink, sitting erect at his desk and reading some fat book as if for dear life. He was positioned sideways to Jack, who had time to take in Richard's dear, well-known profile before he rapped on the glass. Richard's head jerked up from the book. He stared wildly about him, frightened and surprised by the sudden noise. "Richard," Jack said softly, and was rewarded by the sight of his friend's astonished face turning toward him. Richard looked almost moronic with surprise. "Open the window," Jack said, mouthing the words with exaggerated care so that his friend could read his lips. Richard stood up from his desk, still moving with the slowness of shock. Jack mimed pushing the window up. When Richard reached the window, he put his hands on the frame and looked down severely at Jack for a moment. In that short and critical glance was a judgment about Jack's dirty face and unwashed lank hair, his unorthodox arrival, much else. "What on earth are you up to now?" Finally, he pushed up the window. "Well," Richard said, "most people use the door." "Great," Jack said, almost laughing. "When I'm like most people, I probably will, too. Stand back, okay?" Looking very much as though he had been caught off guard, Richard stepped a few paces back. Jack hoisted himself up onto the sill and slid through the window head first. "Oof!" "Okay, hi," Richard said. "I suppose it's even sort of nice to see you, but I have to go to lunch pretty soon. You could take a shower, I guess. Everybody else will be down in the dining room." He stopped talking, as if startled that he had said so much. Richard, Jack saw, would require delicate handling. "Could you bring some food back for me? I'm really starving." "Great," Richard said. "First you get everybody crazy, including my dad, by running away. Then you break in here like a burglar, and now you want me to steal food for you. Fine, sure, okay, great." "We have a lot to talk about," Jack said. "If," Richard said, leaning slightly forward with his hands in his pockets, "if you'll start going back to New Hampshire today, or if you'll let me call my dad and get him here to take you back, I'll try to grab some extra food for you." "I'm willing to talk about anything with you, Richie boy, anything. I'll talk about going back, sure." Richard nodded. "Where in the world have you been, anyhow?" His eyes burned beneath their thick lenses. Then a big, surprising blink. "And how in the world can you justify the way you and your mother are treating my father? Shit, Jack! I really think you ought to go back to that place in New Hampshire." "I will go back," Jack said. "That's a promise. But I have to get something first. Is there any place I can sit down? I'm sort of dead tired." Richard nodded at his bed, then typically flapped one hand at his desk chair, which was nearer Jack. Doors slammed in the hallway. Loud voices passed by Richard's door, a crowd's shuffling feet. "You ever read about the Sunlight Home?" Jack asked. "I was there. Two of my friends died at the Sunlight Home. And get this, Richard, the second one was a werewolf." Richard's face tightened. "Well, That's an amazing coincidence, because I really was at the Sunlight home, Richard.
So I gather, said Richard.
Okay, I'll be back with some food in about half an hour. Then I'll have to tell you who lives next door. But this is Seabrook Island stuff, isn't it? Tell me the truth.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Jack let Miles P. Kiger's coat slip off his shoulders and fold itself over the back of the chair.
I'll be back, Richard said.
He waved uncertainly to Jack on his way out the door. Jack kicked off his shoes and closed his eyes. The conversation to which Richard had alluded as Seabrook Island stuff, and which Jack remembered as well as his friend, took place in the last week of their final visit to the resort of that name. The two families had taken joint vacations nearly every year while Phil Sawyer was alive. The summer after his death, Morgan Sloat and Lily Sawyer had tried to keep the tradition going and booked the four of them into the vast old hotel on Seabrook Island, South Carolina, which had been the site of some of their happiest summers. The experiment had not worked. The boys were accustomed to being in each other's company. They were also accustomed to places like Seabrook Island. Richard Sloat and Jack Sawyer had scampered through resort hotels and down vast tanned beaches all through their childhood, but now the climate had mysteriously altered. An unexpected seriousness had entered their lives, an awkwardness. The death of Phil Sawyer had changed the very color of the future. Jack began to feel that final summer at Seabrook that he might not want to sit in the chair behind his father's desk, that he wanted more in his life. More what? He knew, this was one of the few things he did truly know, that this powerful moreness was connected to the daydreams. When he had begun to see this in himself, he became aware of something else, that his friend Richard was not only incapable of sensing this quality of moreness, but that, in fact, he quite clearly wanted its opposite. Richard wanted less. Richard did not want anything he could not respect. Jack and Richard had sloped off by themselves in that slow-breathing time composed at good resorts by the hours between lunch and cocktails. In fact, they had not gone far, only up at the side of a pine-tree-covered hill overlooking the rear of the inn. Beneath them sparkled the water of the inn's huge rectangular pool, through which Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer smoothly and efficiently swam length after length. At one of the tables set back from the pool sat Richard's father, wrapped in a bulging, fuzzy terrycloth robe, flip-flops on his white feet, simultaneously eating a club sandwich and wheeling and dealing on the plug-in telephone in his other hand. "Is this sort of stuff what you want?" he asked Richard, who was seated neatly beside his own sprawl and held, no surprise, a book, The Life of Thomas Edison. "What I want when I grow up, you mean?" Richard seemed a little nonplussed by the question. "It's pretty nice, I guess. I don't know if I want it or not." "Do you know what you want, Richard? You always say you want to be a research chemist," Jack said. "Why do you say that? What does it mean?"
"It means that I want to be a research chemist," Richard smiled.
"You know what I mean, don't you? What's the point of being a research chemist? Do you think that would be fun? Do you think you'll cure cancer and save millions of people's lives?"
Richard looked at him very openly, his eyes slightly magnified by the glasses he had begun to wear 4 months earlier.
"I don't think I'll ever cure cancer, no. But that's not even the point. The point is finding out how things work. The point is that things actually really do work in an orderly way in spite of how it looks, and you can find out about it."
"Order?"
"Yeah. So why are you smiling?"
Jack grinned.
"You're going to think I'm crazy. I'd like to find something that makes all this, all these rich guys chasing golf balls and yelling into telephones, that makes all this look sick."
"It already looks sick," Richard said, with no intention of being funny.
"Don't you sometimes think there's more to life than order?" He looked over at Richard's innocent, skeptical face. "Don't you want just a little magic, Richard?"
"You know, sometimes I think you just want chaos," Richard said, flushing a bit.
"I think you're making fun of me. If you want magic, you completely wreck everything I believe in. In fact, you wreck reality."
"Maybe there isn't just one reality."
"In Alice in Wonderland, sure."
Richard was losing his temper. He stomped off through the pines, and Jack realized for the first time that the talk released by his feelings about the daydreams had infuriated his friend. Jack's longer legs brought him alongside Richard in seconds.
"I wasn't making fun of you," he said. "It's just, I was sort of curious about why you always say you want to be a chemist."
Richard stopped short and looked soberly up at Jack.
"Just stop driving me crazy with that kind of stuff," Richard said. "That's just Seabrook Island talk. It's hard enough being one of the 6 or 7 sane people in America without having my best friend flip out totally."
From then on, Richard Sloat bristled at any signs of fancifulness in Jack, and immediately dismissed it as Seabrook Island stuff. By the time Richard returned from the dining room, Jack, freshly showered and with his wet hair adhering to his scalp, was idly turning over books at Richard's desk. Jack was wondering as Richard swung through the door, carrying a grease-stained paper napkin clearly wrapped around a substantial quantity of food, whether the conversation to come might be easier if the books on the desk were The Lord of the Rings and Watership Down instead of organic chemistry and mathematical puzzles.
"What was lunch?" Jack asked.
"You got lucky. Southern fried chicken. One of the few things they serve here that don't make you sorry for the animal who died to become part of the food chain."
He handed the greasy napkin over to Jack. 4 thick, richly battered sections of chicken sent up an aroma of almost unbelievable goodness and density. Jack weighed it in.
"How long have you been eating as though you oinked?"
Richard pushed his glasses up on his nose and sat down on his narrow bed. Beneath his tweed jacket, he wore a patterned brown V-neck sweater, the bottom of which had been tucked into the waistband of his trousers. Jack had an uneasy moment, wondering if it were really possible to talk about the territories with someone so tightly buttoned that he tucked his sweaters beneath his belts.
"The last time I ate," he said mildly, "was yesterday around noon."
"I'm a little hungry, Richard. Thanks for bringing me the chicken. It's great. It's the best chicken I ever ate."
"You're a great guy, risking expulsion like this."
"You think that's a joke, do you?"
Richard yanked at the sweater, frowning. "If anybody finds you in here, I probably will get expelled, so don't get too funny. We have to figure out how we're going to get you back to New Hampshire."
Silence, then, for a moment. An appraising look from Jack, a stern look from Richard.
"I know you want me to explain what I'm doing, Richard," Jack said, around a mouthful of chicken, "and believe me, it's not going to be easy."
"You don't look the same, you know," Richard said. "You look older. But that's not all. You're changed."
"I know I've changed. You'd be a little different, too, if you'd been with me since September."
Jack smiled, looked at scowling Richard in his good boy clothes, and knew that he would never be able to tell Richard about his father. He simply was not capable of that. If events did it for him, so be it. But he himself did not possess the assassin's heart required for that particular disclosure. His friend continued to frown at Jack, clearly waiting for the story to begin. Perhaps to stall the moment when he would have to try to convince rational Richard of the unbelievable, Jack asked, "Is the kid in the next room quitting school? I saw his suitcases on his bed from outside."
"Well, yes, that's interesting," Richard said. "I mean, interesting in the light of what you said. He is leaving. In fact, he's already gone. Someone is supposed to come for his things, I guess. God knows what kind of a fairy tale you'll make of this, but the kid next door was Ruel Gardner, the son of that preacher who ran that home you claim you escaped from."
Richard ignored Jack's sudden fit of coughing.
"In most senses, I should say, Ruel was anything but the normal kid next door, and probably nobody here was too sorry to see him go. Just when the story came out about kids dying at that place his father ran, he got a telegram ordering him to leave Thayer."
Jack had gotten down the wad of chicken that had tried to choke him.
Sunlight Gardner's son? That guy had a son and he was here?
"He came at the start of the term," Richard said simply. "That's what I was trying to tell you before."
Suddenly Thayer School was menacing to Jack in a way that Richard could not begin to comprehend.
"What was he like?"
"A sadist," Richard said. "Sometimes I heard really peculiar noises coming out of Rule's room, and once I saw a dead cat on the garbage thing on him back that didn't have any eyes or ears." When you saw him, you'd think he was the kind of person who might torture a cat, and he sort of smelled like rancid English leather, I thought.
Richard was silent for a carefully timed moment, and then asked, "Were you really in the Sunlight Home?"
For 30 days. It was hell, or hell's next-door neighbor.
He inhaled, looking at Richard's scowling, but now at least half-convinced face.
"This is hard for you to swallow, Richard, and I know that, but the guy with me was a werewolf, and if he hadn't been killed while he was saving my life, he'd be here right now."
"A werewolf? Hair on the palms of his hands. Changes into a bloodthirsty monster every full moon."
Richard looked musingly around the little room. Jack waited until Richard's gaze returned to him.
"Do you want to know what I'm doing? Do you want me to tell you why I'm hitchhiking all the way across the country?"
"I'm going to start screaming if you don't," Richard said.
"Well," Jack said, "I'm trying to save my mother's life."
As he uttered it, this sentence seemed to him filled with a wondrous clarity.
"How the hell are you going to do that?" Richard exploded. "Your mother probably has cancer. As my father's been pointing out to you, she needs doctors and science, and you hit the road? What are you going to use to save your mother, Jack? Magic?"
Jack's eyes began to burn.
"You got it, Richard, old chum."
He raised his arm and pressed his already damp eyes into the fabric at the crook of his elbow.
"Oh, hey, calm down. Hey, really," Richard said, tugging frantically at his sweater. "Don't cry, Jack. Come on, please. I know it's a terrible thing. I didn't mean to... It was just that..."
Richard had crossed the room instantly and without noise, and was now awkwardly patting Jack's arm and shoulder.
"I'm okay," Jack said. He lowered his arm.
"It's not some crazy fantasy, Richard, no matter how it looks to you."
He sat up straight.
"My father called me Traveling Jack, and so did an old man in Arcadia Beach."
Jack hoped he was right about Richard's sympathy opening internal doors. When he looked at Richard's face, he saw that it was true. His friend looked worried, tender, foursquare. Jack began his story. Around the two boys, the life of Nelson House went on, both calm and boisterous in the manner of boarding schools, punctuated with shouts and roars and laughter. Footsteps padded past the door but did not stop. From the room above came regular thumps and an occasional drift of music Jack finally recognized as a record by Blue Oyster Cult. He began by telling Richard about the daydreams. From the daydreams he went to Speedy Parker. He described the voice speaking to him from the whirling funnel in the sand. And then he told Richard of how he had taken Speedy's magic juice and first flipped into the territories.
"But I think it was just cheap wine. Wino wine," Jack said. "Later, after it was all gone, I found out that I didn't need it to flip. I could just do it by myself."
"Okay," Richard said noncommittally. He tried to truly represent the territories to Richard. The cart track, the site of the summer palace, the timelessness and specificity of it. Captain Farron, the dying queen, which brought him to Twinners. Osmond, the scene at All Hands Village, the outpost road, which was the western road. He showed Richard his little collection of sacred objects, the guitar pick and marble and coin. Richard merely turned these over in his fingers and gave them back without comment. Then Jack relived his wretched time in Oatley. Richard listened to Jack's tales of Oatley, silent but wide-eyed. Jack carefully omitted Morgan Sloat and Morgan Avoris from his account of the scene at the Lewisburg rest area on I-70 in western Ohio. Then Jack had to describe Wolf as he had first seen him, that beaming giant in Oshkosh Bagosh bib overalls, and he felt his tears building again behind his eyes. He did actually startle Richard by weeping while he told about trying to get Wolf into cars, and confessed his impatience with his companion, fighting not to weep again, and was fine for a long time. He managed to get through the story of Wolf's first change without tears or a constricted throat. Then he struck trouble again. His rage kept him talking freely until he got to Ferd Janklow, and then his eyes grew hot again. Richard said nothing for a long time. Then he stood up and fetched a clean handkerchief from a bureau drawer. Jack noisily, wetly blew his nose.
"That's what happened," Jack said. "Most of it, anyhow. What have you been reading? What movies have you been seeing?"
"Fuck you," Jack said. He stood up and walked across the room to get his pack, but Richard reached out and put his hand around Jack's wrist.
"I don't think you made it all up. I don't think you made any of it up."
"Don't you?"
"No. I don't know what I do think, actually, but I'm sure you're not telling me deliberate lies."
He dropped his hand. "I believe you were in the Sunlight Home. I believe that, all right. And I believe that you had a friend named Wolf who died there. I'm sorry, but I cannot take the territory seriously, and I cannot accept that your friend was a werewolf."
"So you think I'm nuts?" Jack said.
"I think you're in trouble. But I'm not going to call my father, and I'm not going to make you leave now. You'll have to sleep in the bed here tonight. If we hear Mr. Haywood coming around to do bed checks, you'll be able to hide under the bed."
Richard had taken on a faintly executive air, and he put his hands on his hips and glanced critically around his room.
"You have to get some rest. I'm sure that's part of the problem. They worked you half to death in that horrible place, and your mind got twisted, and now you need to rest."
"I do," Jack admitted.
Richard rolled his eyes upward. "I have to go to intramural basketball pretty soon, but you can hide in here, and I'll bring some more food back from the dining room later on. The important thing is you need rest, and you need to get back home."
Jack said, "New Hampshire isn't home."
Chapter 30. Thayer Gets Weird. Through the window, Jack could see boys in coats, hunched against the cold, crossing to and fro between the library and the rest of the school. Etheridge, the senior who had spoken to Jack that morning, bustled by, his scarf flying out behind him. Richard took a tweed sport jacket from the narrow closet beside the bed.
"Nothing is going to make me think that you should do anything but go back to New Hampshire. I have to go to basketball now, because if I don't, Coach Fraser will make me do 10 punishment laps as soon as he comes back. Some other coach is taking our practice today, and Fraser said he'd run us into the ground if we cut out. Do you want to borrow some clean clothes? I at least have a shirt that'll fit you. My father sent it to me from New York, and Brooks Brothers got the size wrong."
"Let's see it," Jack said. His clothes had become definitely disreputable, so stiff with filth that whenever he noticed it, Jack felt like Pigpen, the Peanuts character, who lived in a mist of dirt and disapproval. Richard gave him a white button-down still in its plastic bag.
"Great, thanks," Jack said.
He took it out of the bag and began removing the pins. It would almost fit.
"There's a jacket you might try on, too," Richard said. "The blazer hanging at the end of the closet. Try it on, okay? And you might as well use one of my ties, too, just in case anyone comes in. Say you're from St. Louis Country Day, and you're on a newspaper exchange. We do two or three of those a year. Kids from here go there, kids from there come here, to work on the other school's paper."
He went toward the door.
"I'll come back before dinner and see how you are."
Two ballpoints were clipped to a plastic insert in his jacket pocket, Jack noticed, and all the buttons of the jacket were buttoned. Nelson House grew perfectly quiet within minutes. From Richard's window, Jack saw boys seated at desks in the big library windows. Nobody moved on the paths or over the crisp brown grass. An insistent bell rang, marking the beginning of fourth period. Jack stretched his arms out and yawned. A feeling of security returned to him, a school around him, with all those familiar rituals of bells and classes and basketball practices. Maybe he would be able to stay another day. Maybe he would even be able to call his mother from one of the Nelson House phones. He would certainly be able to catch up on his sleep. Jack went to the closet and found the blazer hanging where Richard had said it would be. A tag still hung from one of the sleeves. Sloat had sent it from New York, but Richard had never worn it. Like the shirt, the blazer was one size too small for Jack and clung too tightly to his shoulders, but the cut was roomy and the sleeves allowed the white shirt cuffs to peek out half an inch. Jack lifted a necktie from the hook just inside the closet, red with a pattern of blue anchors. Jack slipped the tie around his neck and laboriously knotted it. Then he examined himself in the mirror and laughed out loud. Jack saw that he had made it at last. He looked at the beautiful new blazer, the club tie, his snowy shirt, his rumpled jeans. He was there. He was a preppy. Richard had become, Jack saw, an admirer of John McPhee and Lewis Thomas and Stephen Jay Gould. He picked The Panda's Thumb from the row of books on Richard's shelves because he liked the title, and returned to the bed. Richard did not return from his basketball practice for what seemed an impossibly long time. Jack paced back and forth in the little room. He could not imagine what would keep Richard from returning to his room, but his imagination gave him one calamity after another. After the fifth or sixth time Jack checked his watch, he noticed that he could see no students on the grounds. Whatever had happened to Richard had happened to the entire school. The afternoon died. Richard, too, he thought, was dead. Perhaps all Thayer School was dead, and he was a plague-bearer, a carrier of death. He had eaten nothing all day since the chicken Richard had brought him from the dining room, but he wasn't hungry. Jack sat in numb misery. He brought destruction wherever he went. Then there were footfalls in the corridor once more. From the floor above, Jack now dimly heard the thud, thud, thud of a bass pattern, and then again recognized it as being from a record by Blue Oyster Cult. The footsteps paused outside the door. Jack hurried to the door. Richard stood in the doorway. Two boys with corn silk hair and half-mast ties glanced in and kept moving down the corridor. The rock music was much more audible in the corridor. "Where were you all afternoon?" Jack demanded. "Well, it was sort of freaky," Richard said. "They canceled all the afternoon classes. Mr. Duffery wouldn't even let kids go back to their lockers. And then we all had to go to basketball practice, and that was even weirder." "Who's Mr. Duffery?" Richard looked at him as if he'd just tumbled out of a bassinet. "Who's Mr. Duffery? He's the headmaster. Don't you know anything at all about this school?"
"No, but I'm getting a few ideas," Jack said. "What was so weird about practice? Remember I told you that Coach Fraser got some friend of his to handle it today? Well, he said we'd all get punishment laps if we tried to cut out, so I thought his friend would be some Al McGuire type, you know? Some real hotshot. Thayer School doesn't have a very good athletic tradition. Anyhow, I thought his replacement must be somebody really special. Let me guess. The new guy didn't look like he had anything to do with sports."
Richard lifted his chin, startled.
"No," he said. "No, he didn't."
He gave Jack a considering look.
"He smoked all the time, and his hair was really long and greasy. He didn't look anything like a coach. He looked like somebody most coaches would like to step on, to tell you the truth. Even his eyes looked funny. I bet you he smokes pot."
Richard tugged at his sweater.
"I don't think he knew anything about basketball. He didn't even make us practice our patterns. That's what we usually do after the warm-up period. We sort of ran around and threw baskets, and he shouted at us, laughing, like kids playing basketball was the most ridiculous thing he'd seen in his whole life. You ever see a coach who thought sports was funny? Even the warm-up period was strange. He just said, 'Okay, do push-ups,' and smoked his cigarette. No count, no cadence, everybody just doing them by themselves. After that, it was, 'Okay, run around a little bit.' He looked really wild. I think I'm going to complain to Coach Fraser tomorrow."
"I wouldn't complain to him or the headmaster either," Jack said.
"Oh, I get it," Richard said. "Mr. Duffery's one of them, one of the territory's people."
"Or he works for them," Jack said.
"Don't you see that you could fit anything into that pattern? Anything that goes wrong, it's too easy. You can explain everything that way. That's how craziness works. You make connections that aren't real
and see things that aren't there." Richard shrugged, and despite the insouciance of the gesture, his face was miserable.
"You said it."
"Wait a minute," Jack said.
"You remember me telling you about the building that collapsed in Angola, New York? The Rainbird Towers.
What a memory.
I think that accident was my fault."
"Jack, you're..."
Jack said, "Crazy, I know. Look, would anyone blow the whistle on me if we went out and watched the evening news?"
"I doubt it. Most kids are studying now anyway. Why?" Because I want to know what's been happening around here, Jack thought but did not say. Sweet little fires, nifty little earthquakes, signs that they're coming through. For me, for us.
I need a change of scenery, Richard, old chum, Jack said, and followed Richard down the watery green corridor.
Chapter 31. Thayer Goes to Hell. Jack became aware of the change first and recognized what had happened. It had happened before, while Richard was out, and he was sensitized to it. The screaming heavy metal of Blue Oyster Cult's tattoo vampire was gone. The TV in the common room, which had been cackling out an episode of Hogan's Heroes instead of the news, had fallen dormant. Richard turned toward Jack, opening his mouth to speak.
"I don't like it, Gridley," Jack said first. "The native tom-toms have stopped. It's too quiet."
"Ha-ha," Richard said thinly. "Richard, can I ask you something?"
"Yes, of course."
"Are you scared?"
Richard's face said that he wanted more than anything to say, "No, of course not. It always gets quiet around Nelson House this time of the evening." Unfortunately, Richard was utterly incapable of telling a lie.
"Dear old Richard," Jack felt a wave of affection.
"Yes," Richard said, "I'm a little scared."
"Can I ask you something else?"
"I guess so. Why are we both whispering?"
Richard looked at him for a long time without saying anything. Then he started down the green corridor again. The doors of the other rooms on the other corridor were either open or ajar. Jack smelled a very familiar odor wafting through the half-open door of Suite 4 and pushed the door all the way open with tented fingers.
"Which one of them is the pothead?" Jack asked.
"What?" Richard replied uncertainly. Jack sniffed loudly.
"Smell it?"
Richard came back and looked into the room. Both study lamps were on. There was an open history text on one desk, an issue of heavy metal on the other. Posters decorated the walls, the Costa del Sol, Frodo and Sam trudging across the cracked and smoking plains of mortar toward Soren's castle, Eddie Van Halen. Earphones lay on the open issue of heavy metal, giving out tinny little squeaks of music.
"If you can get expelled for letting a friend sleep under your bed, I doubt if they just slap your wrist for smoking pot, do they?" Jack said.
"They expel you for it, of course." Richard was looking at the joint as if mesmerized, and Jack thought he looked more shocked and bewildered than he had at any other time, even when Jack had shown him the healing burns between his fingers.
"Nelson House is empty," Jack said.
"Don't be ridiculous."
Richard's voice was sharp.
"It is, though." Jack gestured down the hall. "We're the only ones left. And you don't get 30-some boys out of a dorm without a sound. They didn't just leave, they disappeared."
"Over into the territories, I suppose."
"I don't know," Jack said. "Maybe they're still here, but on a slightly different level. Maybe they're there, maybe they're in Cleveland, but they're not where we are."
"Close that door," Richard said abruptly. And when Jack didn't move quickly enough to suit him, Richard closed it himself.
"Do you want to put out the..."
"I don't even want to touch it," Richard said. "I ought to report them, you know. I ought to report them both to Mr. Haywood."
"Would you do that?" Jack asked, fascinated. Richard looked chagrined.
"No, probably not," he said, "but I don't like it."
"Not orderly," Jack said.
"Yeah."
Richard's eyes flashed at him from behind his spectacles, telling him that was exactly right. He had hit the nail on the head, and if Jack didn't like it, he could lump it.
He started down the hall again. "I want to know what's going on around here," he said, "and believe me, I'm going to find out."
"That might be a lot more hazardous to your health than marijuana, Richie boy," Jack thought, and followed his friend. They stood in the lounge looking out. Richard pointed toward the quad. In the last of the dying light, Jack saw a bunch of boys grouped loosely around the greenish-bronze statue of Elder Thayer.
"They're smoking," Richard cried angrily. "Right on the quad, they're smoking."
Jack thought immediately of the pot smell in Richard's hall.
"They're smoking, all right," he said to Richard, "and not the kind of cigarettes you get out of a cigarette machine either."
Richard rapped his knuckles angrily on the glass. For him, Jack saw the weirdly deserted dorm was forgotten. The leather-jacketed, chain-smoking substitute coach was forgotten. Jack's apparent mental aberration was forgotten. That look of outraged propriety on Richard's face said, when a bunch of boys stand around like that, smoking joints within touching distance of the statue of the founder of this school, it's as if someone were trying to tell me that the earth is flat, or that prime numbers may sometimes be divisible by two, or something equally ridiculous. Jack's heart was full of pity for his friend, but it was also full of admiration for an attitude which must seem so reactionary and even eccentric to his schoolmates. He wondered again if Richard could stand the shocks which might be on the way. "Richard," he said, "those boys aren't from Thayer, are they?"
"God, you really have gone crazy, Jack. They're uppers. I recognize every last one of them. The guy wearing that stupid leather flying hat is Norrington. The one in the green sweater pants is Buckley. I see Garson, Littlefield. The one with the scarf is Etheridge," he finished.
"Are you sure it's Etheridge?"
"Of course it's him," Richard shouted. He suddenly turned the catch on the window, rammed it up, and leaned out into the cold air.
Jack pulled Richard back. "Richard, please, just listen." Richard didn't want to. He turned and leaned out into the cold twilight.
"Hey! No, don't attract their attention, Richard, for Christ's sake. Hey, you guys! Etheridge, Norrington, Littlefield, what in the hell is going on out there?"
The talk and rough laughter broke off. The fellow who was wearing Etheridge's scarf turned toward the sound of Richard's voice. He tilted his head slightly to look up at them. The lights from the library and the sullen furnace afterglow of the winter sunset fell on his face. Richard's hands flew to his mouth. The right half of the face disclosed was actually a bit like Etheridge's, an older Etheridge, an Etheridge who had been in a lot of places nice prep school boys didn't go, and who had done a lot of things nice prep school boys didn't do. The other half was a twisted mass of scars. A glittery crescent that might have been an eye peered from a crater in the lumpy mess of flesh below the forehead. It looked like a marble that had been shoved deeply into a puddle of half-melted tallow. A single long fang hooked out of the left corner of the mouth. "It's his twinner," Jack thought with utter calm certainty. "That's Etheridge's twinner down there. Are they all twinners? A Littlefield twinner and a Norrington twinner and a Buckley twinner and so on and so on? That can't be, can it?" "Slout!" the Etheridge thing cried. It shambled two steps toward Nelson House. The glow from the streetlights on the drive now fell directly onto its ruined face. "Shut the window," Richard whispered. "Shut the window. I was wrong. It sort of looks like Etheridge, but it's not. Maybe it's his older brother. Maybe someone threw battery acid or something in Etheridge's brother's face, and now he's crazy. But it's not Etheridge. So close the window, Jack. Close it right now." Below, the Etheridge thing shambled yet another step toward them. It grinned. Its tongue, hideously long, fell out of its mouth like an unrolling party favor. "Slout!" it cried. "Give us your passenger!" Jack and Richard both jerked around, looking at each other with strained faces. A howl shivered in the night, for it was night now, twilight was done. Richard looked at Jack, and for a moment Jack saw something like real hate in the other boy's eyes, a flash of his father. "Why did you have to come here, Jack? Huh? Why did you have to bring me this mess? Why did you have to bring me all this goddamn Seabrook Island stuff?" "Do you want me to go?" Jack asked softly. For a moment that look of harried anger remained in Richard's eyes, and then it was replaced by Richard's old kindness. "No," he said, running distracted hands through his hair. "No, you're not going anywhere. There are wild dogs out there. Wild dogs, Jack, on the Thayer campus. I mean, did you see them?" "Yeah, I saw them, Richie boy," Jack said softly, as Richard ran his hands through his formerly neat hair again, mussing it into ever wilder tangles. Jack's neat and orderly friend was starting to look a little bit like Donald Duck's amiably mad inventor cousin, Gyro Gearloose.
"Call Boynton. He's security, that's what I have to do," Richard said. "Call Boynton, or the town police, or—"
A howl rose from the trees on the far side of the quad, from the gathered shadows there, a rising, wavering howl that was really almost human. Richard looked toward it, mouth trembling in an infirm old person's way, and then he looked pleadingly at Jack.
"Close the window, Jack, okay? I feel feverish. I think maybe I've gotten a chill."
"You bet, Richard," Jack said, and closed it, shutting the howl out as best he could. Chapter 32. Send out your passenger.
Help me with this, Richard, Jack grunted.
I don't want to move the bureau, Jack, Richard said in a childish, lecturing voice.
Those dark circles under his eyes were even more pronounced now than they had been in the lounge.
That's not where it belongs.
Out on the quad, that howl rose in the air again. The bed was in front of the door. Richard's room was now pulled entirely out of shape. Richard stood looking around at this, blinking. Then he went to his bed and pulled off the blankets. He handed one to Jack without speaking, then took his and spread it on the floor. He took his change and his billfold out of his pockets and put them neatly on the bureau. Then he lay down in the middle of the blanket, folded the sides over himself, and then just lay there on the floor, his glasses still on, his face a picture of silent misery. The silence outside was thick and dreamlike, broken only by the distant growls of the big rigs on the turnpike. Nelson House itself was eerily silent.
"I don't want to talk about what's outside," Richard said. "I just want that up front."
"Okay, Richard," Jack said soothingly. "We won't talk about it."
"Good night, Jack."
"Good night, Richard." Richard gave him a smile that was wan and terribly tired, yet there was enough sweet friendliness in it to both warm Jack's heart and wrench it.
"I'm still glad you came," Richard said, "and we'll talk about all of this in the morning. I'm sure it will make more sense then. This little fever I have will be gone then."
Richard rolled over on his right side and closed his eyes. 5 minutes later, in spite of the hard floor, he was deeply asleep. Jack sat up for a long time, looking out into the darkness. Sometimes he could see the lights of passing cars on Springfield Avenue. At other times, both the headlights and the street lamps themselves seemed to be gone, as if the entire Thayer school kept side-slipping out of reality and hanging in limbo for a while before slipping back in again. A wind was rising. Jack could hear it rattling the last frozen leaves from the trees on the quad, could hear it knocking the branches together like bones, could hear it shrieking coldly in the spaces between the buildings. "That guy's coming," Jack said tensely. It was an hour or so later. Etheridge's twinner.
"Has that?"
"Never mind," Jack said. "Go back to sleep. You don't want to see." But Richard was sitting up. Before his eye could fix on the slumped, somehow twisted form walking toward Nelson House, it was abducted by the campus itself. He was profoundly shocked, deeply frightened. The ivy on the Monkson Field House, which had that morning been skeletal but still faintly green, had now gone an ugly, blighted yellow.
"Sloat, give us your passenger!"
Suddenly all Richard wanted to do was to go back to sleep, go to sleep until his flu was all gone. He had awakened deciding it must be the flu, not just a chill or fever, but a real case of the flu and the fever that was giving him such horrid, twisted hallucinations. He should never have stood by that open window, or earlier allowed Jack through the window of his room. Richard thought this, and was then deeply and immediately ashamed. Jack shot a quick sideways glance at Richard, but his pallid face and bulging eyes suggested to Jack that Richard was edging farther and farther into the magical land of overload. The thing out there was short. It stood on the frost-whitened grass like a troll that had crawled out from under some bridge, its long clawed hands hanging almost to its knees. It wore an army duffel coat with Etheridge stenciled above the left pocket. The jacket hung unzipped and open. Beneath it, Jack could see a torn and rumpled Pendleton shirt. A dark stain, which might have been either blood or vomit, was splashed over one side. It was wearing a rumpled blue tie with tiny gold uppercase E's woven into the rep fabric. A couple of burrs were stuck on it like grotesque tie tacks. Only half of this new Etheridge's face worked right. There was dirt in its hair and leaves on its clothes.
"Sloat, give us your passenger!"
Jack looked down at Etheridge's freakish twinner again. He was caught and held by its eyes, which were somehow vibrating in their sockets, like tuning forks moving rapidly in their lab mounts. He had to work to drag his eyes away.
"Richard," he grunted, "don't look in its eyes."
Richard didn't reply. He was staring down at the grinning troll version of Etheridge with drugged and pallid interest. Scared, Jack butted his friend with his shoulder.
"Oh,"
Richard said. Abruptly, he snatched up Jack's hand and pressed it against his forehead.
"How hot do I feel?"
he demanded. Jack pulled his hand away from Richard's forehead, which was a bit warm, but no more.
"Pretty hot," he lied.
"I knew it," Richard said with real relief. "I'm going to the infirmary pretty soon, Jack. I think I need an antibiotic."
"Give him to us, Sloat!"
"Let's get the bureau in front of the window," Jack said.
"You're in no danger, Sloat,"
Etheridge called. It grinned reassuringly. The right half of its face grinned reassuringly, anyway. The left half only continued its corpse-like gape.
"How can it look so much like Etheridge?" Richard asked, with unsettling eerie calmness. "How can its voice come through the glass so clearly? What's wrong with its face?"
His voice sharpened a little, and recovered some of its earlier dismay as he asked a final question, one which seemed to be at that moment the most vital question of all, at least to Richard Sloat.
"Where did it get Etheridge's tie, Jack?"
"I don't know," Jack said. "We're back on Seabrook Island for sure, Richie boy, and I think we're going to boogie till you puke."
"Give him to us, Sloat, or we'll come in and get him!"
The Etheridge thing showed its single fang in a ferocious cannibal's grin.
"Send your passenger out, Sloat. He's dead! He's dead, and if you don't send him out soon, you'll smell him when he starts to stink!"
"Help me move the frigging bureau," Jack hissed.
"Yes," Richard said. "Yes, okay. We'll move the bureau, and then I'll lie down. And maybe later I'll go over to the infirmary. What do you think, Jack? What do you say? Is that a good plan?"
His face begged Jack to say it was a good plan.
"We'll see," Jack said. "First things first. The bureau. They might throw stones." Soon after, Richard began to mutter and moan in the sleep which had overtaken him again. That was bad enough. Then tears began to squeeze from the corners of his eyes, and that was worse.
"I can't give him up," Richard moaned in the weepy, bewildered voice of a 5-year-old.
Jack stared at him, his skin cold.
"I can't give him up. I want my daddy. Please, someone tell me where my daddy is. He went into the closet, but he's not in the closet now. I want my daddy. He'll tell me what to do. Please."
A rock came crashing through the window. Jack screamed. It boomed against the back of the bureau in front of the window. A few splinters of glass flew through the gaps to the left and right of the bureau and shattered into smaller pieces on the floor.
"Give us your passenger, Sloat!"
"Can't," Richard moaned, writhing inside the blanket.
"Give him to us!"
another laughing, howling voice from outside screamed.
"We'll take him back to Seabrook Island, Richard! Back to Seabrook Island, where he belongs!"
Another rock. Jack ducked instinctively, although this rock also bounced off the back of the bureau. Dogs howled and yapped and snarled.
"No Seabrook Island," Richard was muttering in his sleep. "Where's my daddy? I want him to come out of that closet. Please, please, no Seabrook Island stuff, please!"
Then Jack was on his knees, shaking Richard as hard as he dared, telling him to wake up. It was just a dream. Wake up. For Christ's sake, wake up.
"Please, please, please!"
A hoarse, inhuman chorus of voices rose outside. The voices sounded like a chorus of manimals from Wells's Island of Dr. Moreau.
"Wake up, wake up, wake up,"
a second chorus responded. Dogs howled. A flurry of stones flew, knocking more glass from the window, bonking against the back of the bureau, making it rock.
"Daddy's in the closet!" Richard screamed. "Daddy, come out! Please come out! I'm afraid!"
"Please, please, please, wake up, wake up, wake up!"
Richard's hands waving in the air. Stones flying, striking the bureau. Soon, a rock big enough to either punch straight through the cheap piece of furniture or to simply knock it over on top of them would come through the window, Jack thought. Outside, they laughed and bellowed and chanted in their hideous troll voices. Dogs, packs of them now, it seemed, howled and growled. "Daddy!" Richard screamed in a chilling, rising voice. Jack slapped him. Richard's eyes jerked open. He stared up at Jack for a moment with a dreadful lack of recognition, as if the dream he'd been having had burned away his sanity. Then he pulled in a long, shaking breath and let it out in a sigh. "Nightmare," he said. "Part of the fever, I guess. Horrible. But I don't remember exactly what it was," he added sharply, as if Jack might ask him this at any moment. "Richard, I want us to get out of this room," Jack said. "Out of this..." Richard looked at Jack as though he must be crazy. "I can't do that, Jack. I'm running a fever of... It must be 103 at least. Might be 104 or 5. I can't..." "You've got a degree of fever at most, Richard," Jack said calmly. "Probably not even that." "I'm burning up," Richard protested. "They're throwing stones, Richard."
"Hallucinations can't throw stones, Jack," Richard said, as if explaining some simple but vital fact to a mental defective. "That's Seabrook Island stuff. It's..." Another volley of rocks flew through the window.
"Send out your passenger, Sloat!"
"Come on, Richard," Jack said, getting the other boy to his feet. He led him to the door and outside. He felt enormously sorry for Richard now. Perhaps not as sorry as he had felt for Wolf, but he was getting there.
"No. Sick. Fever. I can't..." More rocks thudded against the bureau behind them. Richard shrieked and clutched at Jack like a boy who is drowning. Wild, cackling laughter from outside. Dogs howled and fought with each other. Jack saw Richard's white face grow whiter still, saw him sway, and got up in a hurry. But he was not quite in time to catch Richard before he collapsed in Ruel Gardner's doorway. It was a simple fainting spell, and Richard came around quickly enough when Jack pinched the delicate webbings between his thumbs and forefingers. He would not talk about what was outside, affected, in fact, not to know what Jack was talking about. They moved cautiously down the hallway toward the stairs. At the common room, Jack poked his head in and whistled. "Richard, look at this." Richard looked reluctantly in. The common room was a shambles. Chairs were overturned. The cushions on the couch had been slashed open. The oil portrait of Elder Thayer on the far wall had been defaced. Someone had crayoned a pair of devil's horns poking out of his neat white hair. Someone else had added a mustache under his nose. And a third had used a nail file or a similar implement to scratch a crude phallus on his crotch. The glass of the trophy case was shattered. Jack didn't much care for the look of drugged, unbelieving horror on Richard's face. In some ways, elves trooping up and down the halls in glowing, unearthly platoons, or dragons over the quad, would have been easier for Richard to take than this constant erosion of the Thayer school he had come to know and love. The Thayer school Richard undoubtedly believed to be noble and good, an undisputed bulwark against a world where nothing could be counted on for long. Not even, Jack thought, that fathers would come back out of the closets they had gone into. "Who did this?" Richard asked angrily. "Those freaks did it," he answered himself. "That's who."
He looked at Jack, a great cloudy suspicion beginning to dawn on his face.
"They might be Colombians," he said suddenly. "They might be Colombians, and this might be some sort of drug war, Jack. Has that occurred to you?"
Jack had to throttle an urge to bellow out mad gusts of laughter. Here was an explanation which perhaps only Richard Sloat could have conceived. It was the Colombians. The cocaine range wars had come to Thayer School in Springfield, Illinois. Elementary, my dear Watson. This problem has a 7.5% solution.
"I guess anything's possible," Jack said. "Let's take a look upstairs."
"What in God's name for?"
"Well, maybe we'll find someone else," Jack said. He didn't really believe this, but it was something to say. "Maybe someone's hiding out up there, someone normal like us."
Richard looked at Jack, then back at the shambles of the common room.
That look of haunted pain came back into his face again, the look that said, I don't really want to look at this, but for some reason it seems to be all I do want to look at right now. It's bitterly compulsive, like biting a lemon or scratching your fingernails across a blackboard or scraping the tines of fork on the porcelain of a sink. Dope is rampant in the country, Richard said in eerie lecture hall tones. I read an article on drug proliferation in the New Republic just last week. Jack, all those people out there could be doped up. They could be freebasing. They could be... Come on, Richard, Jack said quietly. I'm not sure I can climb the stairs, Richard said, weakly querulous. My fever may be too bad for me to climb stairs. Well, give it the good old Thayer try, Jack said, and continued to lead him in that direction. As they reached the second-floor landing, sound bled back into the smooth, almost breathless silence that had held inside Nelson House. Dogs snarled and barked outside. It sounded as if there were not just dozens or scores of them now, but hundreds. The bells in the chapel burst into a wild jangle of sound. The bells were driving the mongrel dogs, racing back and forth across the quad, absolutely nuts. They turned on each other, rolled over and over on the grass, which was beginning to look ragged, weedy, and unkempt, and savaged anything within mouthshot. As Jack watched, one of them attacked an elm tree. Another launched itself at the statue of Elder Thayer. As its biting, snapping muzzle collided with the solid bronze, blood splashed and sprayed. Jack turned away, sickened. "Come on, Richard," Jack said. Richard came willingly enough. The second floor was a jumbled confusion of overturned furniture, shattered windows, fistfuls of stuffing, records that had apparently been thrown like frisbees, clothes that had been tossed everywhere. The third floor was cloudy with steam and as warmly moist as a tropical rainforest. As they got closer to the door marked showers, the heat went up to sauna levels. The mist they had first encountered creeping down the stairs in thin tendrils grew fog-like and opaque. "Stay here," Jack said. "Wait for me." "Sure, Jack," Richard said serenely, raising his voice enough to be heard over the drumming showers. His glasses had fogged up, but he made no effort to wipe them off. Jack pushed the door open and went in. The heat was soggy and thick. His clothes were soaked at once from sweat and the hot, foggy moisture. The tile-lined room roared and drummed with water. All 20 of the showers had been turned on, and the driving needle spray from all 20 had been focused on a pile of sports equipment in the middle of the tiled room. The water was able to drain through this crazy pile, but only slowly, and the room was awash. Jack took off his shoes and circled the room, sliding under the showers to keep himself as dry as possible, and also to keep himself from being scalded. Whoever had turned on the showers hadn't bothered with the cold faucets, apparently. He turned all of them off one by one. There was no reason for him to do this, no reason at all, and he scolded himself for wasting time in such a way, when he should be trying to think of a way for them to get out of here, out of Nelson House and off the Thayer school grounds, before the axe fell. No reason for it, except that maybe Richard wasn't the only one with a need to create order out of chaos, to create order and to maintain it. He went back into the hall and Richard was gone. Richard? He could feel his heartbeat picking up in his chest. There was no answer. Richard? Spilled cologne hung on the air, noxiously heavy. Richard, where the hell are you? Richard's hand fell on Jack's shoulder, and Jack shrieked. "I don't know why you had to yell like that," Richard said later. "It was only me." "I'm just nervous," Jack said wanly. They were sitting in the third-floor room of a boy with the strangely harmonious name of Albert Humbert. Richard told him that Albert Humbert, whose nickname was Albert the Blob, was the fattest boy in school, and Jack could believe it. His room contained an amazing variety of junk food. It was the stash of a kid whose worst nightmare isn't getting cut from the basketball team or flunking a trig test, but rather waking up in the night and not being able to find a ring ding or a Reese's peanut butter cup. A lot of the stuff had been thrown around. The glass jar containing the marshmallow fluff had been broken, but Jack had never been very wild about marshmallow fluff anyway. He also passed on the licorice whips. Albert the Blob had a whole carton of them stashed on the upper shelf of his closet. Written across one of the carton flaps was, "Happy birthday, dear, from your loving mom." Some loving moms send cartons of licorice whips, and some loving dads send blazers from Brooks Brothers, Jack thought wearily, and if there's any difference, Jason alone knows what it is. They found enough food in the room of Albert the Blob to make a crazy sort of meal, Slim Jim's pepperoni slices, salt and vinegar potato chips. Now they were finishing up with a package of cookies. Jack had retrieved Albert's chair from the hall and was sitting by the window. Richard was sitting on Albert's bed. "Well, you sure are nervous," Richard agreed, shaking his head in refusal when Jack offered him the last cookie. "Paranoid, actually. It comes from spending the last couple of months on the road. You'll be okay once you get home to your mother, Jack." "Richard," Jack said, tossing away the empty Famous Amos bag, "let's cut the shit. Do you see what's going on outside on your campus?" Richard wet his lips. "I explained that," he said. "I have a fever. Probably none of this is happening at all, and if it is, then perfectly ordinary things are going on, and my mind is twisting them, heightening them. That's one possibility. The other is, well, drug pushers." Richard sat forward on Albert the Blob's bed. "You haven't been experimenting with drugs, have you, Jack, while you were on the road?" The old, intelligent, incisive light had suddenly rekindled in Richard's eyes. "Here's a possible explanation, a possible way out of this madness," his eyes said. "Jack has gotten involved in some crazy drug scam, and all of these people have followed him here." "No," Jack said wearily. "I always used to think of you as the master of reality, Richard," Jack said. "I never thought I'd live to see you, using your brains to twist the facts." "Jack, that's just a crock, and you know it." "Drug wars in Springfield, Illinois?" Jack asked. "Who's talking Seabrook Island stuff now?" And that was when a rock suddenly crashed in through Albert Humbert's window, spraying glass across the floor. Chapter 33. Richard in the Dark. Richard screamed and threw an arm up to shield his face. Glass flew.
"Send him out, Sloat!"
Jack got up. Dull fury filled him. Richard grabbed his arm. "Jack, no, stay away from the window." "Fuck that," Jack almost snarled. "I'm tired of being talked about like I was a pizza." The Etheridge thing stood across the road. It was on the sidewalk at the edge of the quad, looking up at them. "Get out of here!" Jack shouted at it. A sudden inspiration burst in his head like a sun flare. He hesitated, then bellowed, "I order you out of here, all of you! I order you to leave in the name of my mother, the Queen!" The Etheridge thing flinched as if someone had used a whip to lay a stripe across its face. Then the look of pain, surprise passed, and the Etheridge thing began to grin.
"She's dead, sire!" it shouted up.
But Jack's eyes had grown sharper somehow in his time on the road, and he saw the expression of twitchy unease under the manufactured triumph.
"Queen Laura's dead, and your mother's dead, too. Dead back in New Hampshire. Dead and stinking."
"Be gone!" Jack bellowed, and he thought that the Etheridge thing flinched back in baffled fury again. Richard had joined him at the window, pallid and distracted. "What are you two yelling about?" he asked. He looked fixedly at the grinning travesty below them and across the way. "How does Etheridge know your mother's in New Hampshire?"
"Sloat!" the Etheridge thing yelled up. "Where's your tie?"
A spasm of guilt contracted Richard's face. His hands jerked toward the open neck of his shirt.
"We'll let it go this time if you send out your passenger, Sloat," the Etheridge thing yelled up. "If you send him out, everything can go back to the way it was. You want that, don't you?"
Richard was staring down at the Etheridge thing, nodding, Jack was sure of it, quite unconsciously. His face was a knotted rag of misery, his eyes bright with unshed tears. He wanted everything to go back to the way it had been, oh yes.
Don't you love this school, Sloat?
The Etheridge thing bellowed up at Albert's window.
Yes,
Richard muttered and gulped down a sob. Yes, of course I love it.
You know what we do to little punks who don't love this school? Give him to us. It'll be like he was never here.
Richard turned slowly and looked at Jack with dreadfully blank eyes. You decide, Richie boy, Jack said softly.
He's carrying drugs, Richard,
the Etheridge thing called up.
4 or 5 different kinds. Coke, hash, angel dust. He's been selling all of that stuff to finance his trip west. Where do you think he got that nice coat he was wearing when he showed up on your doorstep?
Drugs, Richard said with great shuddery relief. I knew it. But you don't believe it, Jack said. Drugs didn't change your school, Richard. And the dog...
Send him out, Sloat.
The Etheridge thing's voice was fading, fading. When the two boys looked down again, it was gone. Where did your father go, do you think? Jack asked softly. Where do you think he went when he didn't come out of the closet, Richard? Richard turned slowly to look at him, and Richard's face, usually so calm and intelligent and serene, now began to shiver into pieces. His chest began to hitch irregularly. Richard suddenly fell into Jack's arms, clutching at him with a blind, panicky urgency.
It touched me,
he screamed at Jack. His body trembled under Jack's hands like a winch wire under a near-breaking strain.
It touched me. Something in there touched me, and I don't know what it was.
With his burning forehead pressed against Jack's shoulder, Richard coughed out the story he had held inside him all these years. It came in hard little chunks, like deformed bullets. As he listened, Jack found himself remembering the time his own father had gone into the garage and had come back 2 hours later from around the block. That had been bad, but what had happened to Richard had been a lot worse. It explained Richard's iron, no-compromise insistence on reality, the whole reality, and nothing but the reality. It explained his rejection of any sort of fantasy, even science fiction. And, Jack knew from his own school experience, technies like Richard usually ate and drank SF. As long as it was the hard stuff, that was, your basic Heinlein, Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Larry Niven, spare us the metaphysical bullshit of the Robert Silverbergs and Barry Maltzbergs, please, but we'll read the stuff where they get all the stellar quadrants and logarithms right until it's running out of our ears. Not Richard, though. Richard's dislike of fantasy ran so deep that he would not pick up any novel unless it was an assignment. As a kid, he had let Jack pick out the books he read for free choice book reports, not caring what they were, chewing them up as if they were cereal. It became a challenge to Jack to find a story, any story, which would please Richard, divert Richard, carry Richard away, as good novels and stories sometimes carry Jack away. The good ones, he thought, were almost as good as the daydreams, and each mapped out its own version of the territories. But he was never able to produce any frisson, any spark, any reaction at all. Whether it was the Red Pony, Drag Strip Demon, The Catcher in the Rye, or I Am Legend, the reaction was always the same. Frowning, dull-eyed concentration, followed by a frowning, dull-eyed book report that would earn either a hook, or, if his English teacher was feeling particularly generous that day, a B-. Richard's C's in English were what kept him off the honor roll during the few marking periods when he missed it. Jack had finished William Golding's Lord of the Flies, feeling hot and cold and trembly all over, both exalted and frightened, most of all wishing what he always wished when the story was most particularly good, that it didn't have to stop, that it could just roll on and on the way that life did, only life was always so much more boring and so much more pointless than stories. He knew Richard had a book report due, and so he had given him the lap-eared paperback, thinking that this must surely do it. This would turn the trick. Richard must react to the story of these lost boys and their descent into savagery. But Richard had plodded through Lord of the Flies as he had plodded through all the other novels before it. and wrote another book report which contained all the zeal and fire of a hungover pathologist's post-mortem on a traffic accident victim. "What is it with you?" Jack had burst out, exasperated. "What in God's name have you got against a good story, Richard?" And Richard had looked at him, flabbergasted, apparently not really understanding Jack's anger. "Well, there's really no such thing as a good made-up story, is there?" Richard had responded. Jack had gone away that day, sorely puzzled by Richard's total rejection of make-believe. But he thought he understood better now. Better than he really wanted to, perhaps. Perhaps to Richard, each opening storybook cover had looked a little like an opening closet door. Perhaps each bright paperback cover, illustrating people who never were as if they were perfectly real, reminded Richard of the morning when he had had enough. Forever. Richard sees his father go into the closet in the big front bedroom, pulling the folding door shut behind him. He is 5, maybe, or 6, surely not as old as 7. He waits 5 minutes, then 10, and when his father still hasn't come out of the closet, he begins to be a little frightened. He calls. He calls for his pipe, he calls for his bowl, he calls for his father, and when his father doesn't answer, he calls in a louder and louder voice, and he goes closer and closer to the closet as he calls. And finally, when 15 minutes have gone by and his father still hasn't come out, Richard pulls the folding door open and goes in. He goes into darkness like a cave. And something happens. After pushing through the rough tweeds and the smooth cottons and the occasional slick silks of his father's coats and suits and sports jackets, the smell of cloth and mothballs and closed-up dark closet air begins to give way to another smell, a hot, fiery smell. Richard begins to blunder forward, screaming his father's name, he thinking there must be a fire back here and his father may be burning in it because it smells like a fire, and suddenly he realizes that the boards are gone under his feet and he is standing in black dirt. Weird black insects with clustered eyes on the ends of long stalks are hopping all around his fuzzy slippers. "Daddy," he screams. "The coats and suits are gone. The floor is gone. But it isn't crisp white snow underfoot. It's stinking black dirt, which is apparently the birthing ground for these unpleasant black jumping insects. This place is by no stretch of the imagination Narnia." Other screams answer Richard's scream, screams and mad, demented laughter. Smoke drifts around him on a dark, idiot wind, and Richard turns, stumbling back the way he came, hands outstretched like the hands of a blind man, feeling frantically for the coats, smelling for the faint, acrid reek of mothballs, and suddenly a hand slithers around his wrist. "Daddy?" he asks, but when he looks down, he sees not a human hand, but a scaly green thing covered with writhing suckers, a green thing attached to a long, rubbery arm which stretches off into the darkness and toward a pair of yellow, upslanted eyes that stare at him with flat hunger. Screeching, he tears free and flings himself blindly into the black. And just as his groping fingers find his father's sport coats and suits again, as he hears the blessed rational sound of jangling coat hangers, that green sucker-lined hand waltzes dryly across the back of his neck again and is gone. He waits, trembling, as pallid as day-old ashes in a cold stove, for 3 hours outside that damned closet, afraid to go back in, afraid of the green hand and the yellow eyes, more and more sure that his father must be dead. And when his father comes back into the room near the end of the 4th hour, not from the closet, but from the door which communicates between the bedroom and the upstairs hall, the door behind Richard, when that happens, Richard rejects fantasy for good and all. Richard negates fantasy. Richard refuses to deal with fantasy or treat with it or compromise with it. He has, quite simply, had enough. Forever. He jumps up, runs to his father, to the beloved Morgan Sloat, and hugs him so tightly that his arms will be sore all that week. Morgan lifts him up, laughs, and asks him why he looks so pale. Richard smiles and tells him that it was probably something he ate for breakfast, but he feels better now, and he kisses his father's cheek and smells the beloved smell of mingled sweat and Raj cologne. And later that day, he takes all of his storybooks, the little golden books, the pop-up books, the I Can Read books, the Dr. Seuss books, the green fairy book for young folks, and he puts them in a carton, and he puts the carton down in the basement, and he thinks, I would not care if an earthquake came now and opened a crack in the floor and swallowed up every one of those books. In fact, it would be a relief. In fact, it would be such a relief that I would probably laugh all day and most of the weekend. This does not happen, but Richard feels a great relief when the books are shut in double darkness, the darkness of the carton and the darkness of the cellar. He never looks at them again, just as he never goes in his father's closet with a folding door again. And although he sometimes dreams that there is something under his bed or in his closet, something with flat yellow eyes, he never thinks about that green sucker-covered hand again until the strange time comes to Thayer School, and he bursts into unaccustomed tears in his friend Jack Sawyer's arms. He has had enough. Forever. Jack had hoped that with the telling of his story and the passing of his tears, Richard would return more or less to his normal, sharply rational self. Jack didn't really care if Richard bought the whole 9 yards or not. If Richard could just reconcile himself to accepting the leading edge of this craziness, he could turn his formidable mind to helping Jack find a way out, a way off the Thayer campus anyway, and out of Richard's life before Richard went totally bananas. But it didn't work that way. When Jack tried to talk to him to tell Richard about the time his own father, Phil, had gone into the garage and hadn't come out, Richard refused to listen. The old secret of what had happened that day in the closet was out, sort of. Richard still clung stubbornly to the idea that it had been a hallucination, but Richard had still had enough forever. The next morning, Jack went downstairs. He got all of his own things and those things he thought Richard might want, toothbrush, textbooks, notebooks, a fresh change of clothes. They would spend that day in Albert the Blob's room, he decided. They could keep an eye on the quad and the gate from up there. When night fell again, maybe they could get away. Jack hunted through Albert's desk and found a bottle of baby aspirin. He looked at this for a moment, thinking that these little orange pills said almost as much about the departed Albert's loving mom as the carton of licorice whips on the closet shelf. Jack shook out half a dozen pills. He gave them to Richard, and Richard took them absently. "Come on over here and lie down," Jack said. "No," Richard answered. His tone was cross and restless and terribly unhappy. He returned to the window.
"I ought to keep a watch, Jack. If this sort of thing is going to happen, someone ought to keep a watch, so a full report can be made to the trustees later."
Jack touched Richard's brow lightly, and although it was cool, almost chilly, he said, "Your fever's worse, Richard. Better lie down until that aspirin goes to work."
"Worse?"
Richard looked at him with pathetic gratitude.
"Is it?"
"It is," Jack said gravely. "Come on and lie down." Richard was asleep 5 minutes after he lay down. Jack sat in Albert the Blob's easy chair, its seat nearly as sprung as the middle of Albert's mattress. Richard's pale face glowed waxily in the growing daylight. Somehow the day passed, and around 4 o'clock Jack fell asleep. He awoke to darkness, not knowing how long he had been out. He only knew there had been no dreams, and for that he was grateful. Richard was stirring uneasily, and Jack guessed he would be up soon. He stood and stretched, wincing at the stiffness in his back. He went to the window, looked out, and stood motionless, eyes wide. His first thought was, "I don't want Richard to see this, not if I can help it." "Oh, God, we've got to get out of here, and just as soon as we can," Jack thought, frightened, "even if for whatever reasons they're afraid to come straight at us." But was he really going to take Richard out of here? They didn't think he would do it. He knew that. They were counting on his refusing to expose his friend to any more of this craziness. Flip, Jacko. You've got to flip over, and you know it. And you've got to take Richard with you because this place is going to hell. I can't. Flipping into the territories would blow Richard's wheels completely. Doesn't matter. You have to do it. It's the best thing anyway, maybe the only thing, because they won't be expecting it. Jack? Richard was sitting up. His face had a strange, naked look without his glasses. Jack, is it over? Was it a dream? Jack sat down on the bed and put an arm around Richard's shoulders. No, he said, his voice low and soothing. It's not over yet, Richard. I think my fever is worse, Richard announced, pulling away from Jack. He drifted over to the window, one of the bows of his glasses pinched delicately between the thumb and forefinger of his right hand. He put his spectacles on and looked out. Shapes with glowing eyes roamed back and forth. He stood there for a long time, and then he did something so un-Richard-like that Jack could barely credit it. He took his glasses off again and deliberately dropped them. There was a frigid little crunch as one lens cracked. Then he stepped deliberately back on them, shattering both lenses to powder. He picked them up, looked at them, and then tossed them unconcernedly toward Albert the Blob's wastebasket. He missed by a wide margin. There was now something softly stubborn in Richard's face, too, something that said, I don't want to see any more, so I won't see any more, and I have taken care of the problem. I have had enough forever. Look at that, he said in a flat, unsurprised voice. I broke my glasses. I had another pair, but I broke them in gym 2 weeks ago. I'm almost blind without them. Jack knew this wasn't true, but he was too flabbergasted to say anything. He could think of absolutely no appropriate response to the radical action Richard had just taken. It had been too much like a calculated last-ditch stand against madness. I think my fever's worse, too, Richard said. Have you got any more of those aspirin, Jack? Jack opened the desk drawer and wordlessly handed Richard the bottle. Richard swallowed 6 or 8 of them, then lay down again. As the night deepened, Richard, who repeatedly promised to discuss their situation, repeatedly went back on his word. He couldn't discuss leaving, he said, couldn't discuss any of this. Not now. His fever had come back, and it felt much, much worse. He thought it might be as high as 105, possibly 106. He said he needed to go back to sleep.
Richard, for Christ's sake, Jack roared. You're punking out on me. Of all the things I never expected from you,
don't be silly, Richard said, falling back onto Albert's bed. I'm just sick, Jack. You can't expect me to talk about all these crazy things when I'm sick. Richard, do you want me to go away and leave you? Richard looked back over his shoulder at Jack for a moment, blinking slowly. You won't, he said, and then went back to sleep. Around 9 o'clock, the campus entered another of those mysterious quiet periods, and Richard, perhaps sensing that there would be less strain put on his tottering sanity now, woke up and swung his legs over the bed. Brown spots had appeared on the walls, and he stared at them until he saw Jack coming toward him. I feel a lot better, Jack, he said hastily, but it really won't do us any good to talk about leaving. It's dark and we have to leave tonight, Jack said grimly. All they have to do is wait us out. There's fungus growing on the walls, and don't tell me you don't see that. Richard smiled with a blind tolerance that nearly drove Jack mad. He loved Richard, but he could cheerfully have pounded him through the nearest fungus-rotted wall. At that precise moment, long, fat, white bugs began to squirm into Albert the Blob's room. They came pushing out of the brown fungoid spots on the wall as if the fungus were in some unknown way giving birth to them. They twisted and writhed half in and half out of the soft brown spots, then plopped to the floor and began squirming blindly toward the bed. Jack had begun to wonder if Richard's sight weren't really a lot worse than he remembered, or if it had degenerated badly since he had last seen Richard. Now he saw that he had been right the first time. Richard could see quite well. He certainly wasn't having any trouble picking up the gelatinous things that were coming out of the walls anyway. He screamed and pressed against Jack, his face frantic with revulsion.
"Bugs, Jack! Oh, Jesus, bugs! Bugs!"
"We'll be all right. Right, Richard?" Jack said. He held Richard in place with a strength he didn't know he had. "We'll just wait for the morning, right? No problem, right?" They were squirming out in dozens, in hundreds, plump, waxy white things, like overgrown maggots. Some burst open when they struck the floor. The rest humped sluggishly across the floor toward them.
"Bugs! Jesus, we have to get out!
We have to thank God this kid finally sees the light," Jack said. He slung his knapsack over his left arm and grabbed Richard's elbow in his right hand. He hustled Richard to the door. White bugs squashed and splattered under their shoes. Now they were pouring out of the brown patches in a flood, an obscene, ongoing multiple birth that was happening all over Albert's room. A stream of the white bugs fell from a patch on the ceiling and landed squirming on Jack's hair and shoulders. He brushed them away as best he could and hauled the screaming, flailing Richard out the door. "I think we're on our way," Jack thought. "God help us, I really think we are." They were in the common room again. Richard, it turned out, had even less idea of how to sneak off the Thayer campus than Jack did himself. Jack knew one thing very well. He was not going to trust that deceptive quiet and go out of any Nelson House's entry doors. Looking hard to the left out of the wide common room window, Jack could see a squat, octagonal brick building. "What's that, Richard?"
"Huh?"
Richard was looking at the gluey, sluggish torrents of mud flowing over the darkening quad. "Little squatty brick building. You can just barely see it from here."
"Oh, the depot."
"What's a depot?"
"The name itself doesn't mean anything anymore," Richard said, still looking uneasily out at the mud-drenched quad. "Like our infirmary. It's called the Creamery because there used to be a real dairy barn and milk bottling plant over there. Until 1910 or so there was, anyway. Tradition, Jack. It's very important. It's one of the reasons I like Thayer."
Richard looked forlornly out at the muddy campus again.
"One of the reasons I always did, anyway."
"The Creamery, okay. How come the depot?" Richard was slowly warming to the twin ideas of Thayer and tradition.
"This whole area of Springfield used to be a railhead," he said. "In fact, in the old days..."
"Which old days are we talking about, Richard?"
"Oh, the 1880s, 1890s. You see..."
Richard trailed off. His nearsighted eyes began moving around the common room, looking for more bugs, Jack supposed. There weren't any, at least not yet. But he could already see a few brown patches beginning to form on the walls. The bugs weren't here yet, but they would be along.
"Come on, Richard," Jack prompted. "No one used to have to prime you to get you to run your mouth."
Richard smiled a little. His eyes returned to Jack.
"Springfield was one of the three or four biggest American railheads during the last two decades of the 19th century. It was geographically handy to all the points of the compass."
He raised his right hand toward his face, forefinger extended to push his glasses up on his nose in a scholarly gesture, realized they were no longer there, and lowered the hand again, looking a bit embarrassed.
"There were main mail routes leaving Springfield for everywhere. This school exists because Andrew Thayer saw the possibilities. He made a fortune in rail shippage, mostly to the West Coast. He was the first one to see the potential in shipping west as well as east."
A bright light suddenly went on in Jack's head, bathing all of his thoughts in its harsh glare. West Coast? His stomach lurched. He could not yet identify the new shape that bright light had shown him, but the word that leaped into his mind was fiery and utterly clear. Talisman.
"West Coast, did you say?"
"Of course I did." Richard looked at Jack strangely.
"Jack, are you going deaf?"
"No," Jack said. "Springfield was one of the three or four biggest American railheads.
No, I'm fine."
"He was the first one to see the potential in shipping west."
"Well, you look damn funny for a minute."
He was, you might say, the first one to see the potential of shipping stuff by rail to the outposts. Jack knew, utterly knew, that Springfield was still a pressure point of some kind, perhaps still a shipping point. That was, perhaps, why Morgan's magic worked so well here. There were coal piles and switching yards and roundhouses and boxcar sheds and about 1 billion miles of tracks and sidings, Richard was saying. It covered this whole area where Thayer School is now. If you dig down a few feet under this turf anywhere, you find cinders and pieces of rail and all sorts of stuff. But all that's left now is that little building, the depot. Of course, it never was a real depot. It's too small. Anyone could see that. It was the main rail yard office, where the station master and the rail boss did their respective things. "You know a hell of a lot about it," Jack said, speaking almost automatically. His head was still filled with that savage new light. "It's part of the Thayer tradition," Richard said simply. "What's it used for now?" "There's a little theater in there. It's for Dramatics Club productions, but the Dramatics Club hasn't been very active over the last couple of years." "Do you think it's locked?" "Why would anyone lock the depot?" Richard asked. "Unless you think someone would be interested in stealing a few flats from the 1979 production of The Fantastics." "So, we could get in there?" "I think so, yes." "But why?" Jack pointed to a door just beyond the ping-pong tables. "What's in there? Vending machines? And a coin-op microwave to heat up snacks and frozen dinners? Jack, come on. Jack, I think my fever's coming back again." Richard smiled weakly. "Maybe we should just stay here for a while. We could just rack out on those sofas for the night." "See those brown patches on the walls?" Jack said grimly, pointing. "No, not without my glasses, of course not." "Well, they're there, and in about an hour those white bugs are going to hatch out of..." "All right," Richard said hastily. The vending machine stank. It looked to Jack as if all the stuff inside them had spoiled. Blue mold coated the cheese crackers and Doritos and Jacks and fried pork rinds. Sluggish creaks of melted ice cream were oozing out of the panels in the front of the Have a Cone machine. Jack pulled Richard toward the window. He looked out. From here, Jack could make out the depot quite well. Beyond it, he could see the chain-link fence and the service road leading off campus. "We'll be out in a few seconds," Jack whispered back. He unlocked the window and ran it up. "This school exists because Andrew Thayer saw the possibilities. Do you see the possibilities, Jacko?" He thought maybe he did. "Are any of those people out there?" Richard asked nervously. "No," Jack said, taking only the most cursory of glances. It didn't really matter if there were or not anymore. One of the 3 or 4 biggest American railheads, a fortune in rail shippage, mostly to the West Coast. He was the first one to see the potential in shipping west. West, west. A thick, mucky mixture of tidal flat aroma and garbage stench drifted in the window. Jack threw one leg over the sill and grabbed for Richard's hand. "Come on," he said. Richard drew back, his face long and miserable with fright. "Jack, I don't know. The place is falling apart," Jack said, "and pretty soon it's going to be crawling with bugs as well. Now come on. Someone's going to see me sitting here in this window, and we'll lose our chance to scurry out of here like a couple of mice." "I don't understand any of this," Richard wailed. "I don't understand what in the goddamn hell is going on here." "Shut up and come on," Jack said, "or I will leave you, Richard. Swear to God I will. I love you, but my mother is dying. I'll leave you to fend for yourself." Richard looked at Jack's face and saw, even without his glasses, that Jack was telling the truth. He took Jack's hand. "God, I'm scared," he whispered. "Join the club," Jack said, and pushed him off. His feet hit the mucky lawn. A second later, Richard jumped down beside him. "We're going to cross to the depot," Jack whispered. "I make it about 50 yards. We'll go in if it's unlocked, try to hide as well as we can on the Nelson House side of it if it isn't. Once we're sure no one's seen us and the place is still quiet, we go for the fence." "Right. Or maybe we'll have to flip, but never mind that just now. The service road. I've got an idea that if we can get off the Thayer grounds, everything will be okay again. Once we get a quarter of a mile down the road, you may look back over your shoulder and see the lights in the dorms and the library just as usual, Richard."
"That'd be so great," Richard said,
with a wistfulness that was heartbreaking.
"Okay, you ready?"
"I guess so," Richard said. "Run to the depot. Freeze against the wall on this side. Low, so those bushes screen you. See them?"
"Yes."
"Okay, go for it." They broke away from Nelson House and ran for the depot side by side. They were less than halfway there, breath puffing out of their mouths in clear white vapor, feet pounding the mucky ground, when the bells in the chapel broke into a hideous, grinding jangle of sound. A howling chorus of dogs answered the bells. They were back, all these were-prefects. Jack groped for Richard and found Richard groping for him, their hands linked together. Richard screamed and tried to pull him off to the left. His hand tightened down on Jack's until the finger bones grated together paralyzingly. A lean white wolf, a bored chairman of wolves, came around the depot and was now racing toward them. That was the old man from the limousine, Jack thought. Other wolves and dogs followed, and then Jack realized with sick surety that some of them were not dogs. Some of them were half-transformed boys, some grown men, teachers, he supposed.
"Mr. Duffery!"
Richard shrieked, pointing with his free hand. "Gee, you see pretty well for someone who's lost his glasses, Richie boy," Jack thought crazily.
"Mr. Duffery! Oh, God, it's Mr. Duffery! Mr. Duffery! Mr. Duffery!"
So Jack got his first and only look at Thayer School's headmaster, a tiny old man with gray hair, a big bent nose, and the wizened, hairy body of an organ grinder's monkey. He ran swiftly along on all fours with the dogs and the boys, a mortar board bobbing crazily up and down on his head and somehow refusing to fall off. He grinned at Jack and Richard, and his tongue, long and lolling and stained yellow with nicotine, fell out through the middle of his grin.
"Mr. Duffery, oh God, oh dear God, Mr. Duffery, Mr. Duffery!"
He was yanking Jack harder and harder toward the left. Jack was bigger, but Richard was in the grip of panic. Explosions rocked the air. That foul, garbagey smell grew thicker and thicker. Jack could hear the soft flopping and plopping of mud squeezing out of the earth. The white wolf which led the pack was closing the distance, and Richard was trying to pull them away from it, trying to pull them toward the fence. And that was right, but it was wrong, too. It was wrong because it was the depot they had to get to, not the fence. That was the spot. That was the spot because this had been one of the three or four biggest American railheads, because Andrew Thayer had been the first one to see the potential in shipping west, because Andrew Thayer had seen the potential, and now he, Jack Sawyer, saw the potential as well. All of this was, of course, only intuition, but Jack had come to believe that in these universal matters, his intuition was the only thing he could trust.
"Let go of your passenger, Sloat," Duffery was gobbling. "Let go of your passenger. He's too pretty for you."
But what's a passenger, Jack thought in those last few seconds, as Richard tried blindly to pull them off course, and Jack yanked him back on toward the mixed bunch of mongrels and boys and teachers that ran behind the big white wolf toward the depot. "I'll tell you what a passenger is. A passenger is one who rides. And where does a passenger begin to ride? Why, at a depot.
Jack, it'll bite!"
Richard screamed. The wolf outran Duffery and leaped at them, its jaws dropping open like a loaded trap. From behind them there was a thick, crunching thud as Nelson House split open like a rotten cantaloupe. Now it was Jack who was bearing down on Richard's finger bones, clamping tight and tighter and tightest as the night rang with crazy bells and flared with gasoline bombs and rattled with firecrackers.
"Hold on!" he screamed. "Hold on, Richard! Here we go!"
He had time to think, now the shoe is on the other foot. Now it's Richard who is the herd, who is my passenger. God help us both.
"Jack, what's happening?" Richard shrieked. "What are you doing? Stop it! Stop it! Stop!"
Richard was still shrieking, but Jack no longer heard him. Suddenly, triumphantly, that feeling of creeping doom cracked open like a black egg, and his brain filled up with light. Light and a sweet purity of air. Air so pure that you could smell the radish a man pulled out of his garden half a mile away. Suddenly Jack felt as if he could simply push off and jump all the way across the quad, or fly, like those men with the wings strapped to their backs.
Oh, there was light and clear air replacing that foul, garbagey stench, and a sensation of crossing voids of darkness, and for a moment everything in him seemed clear and full of radiance. For a moment everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. So Jack Sawyer flipped into the territories again. This time, while running headlong across the degenerating Thayer campus with the sound of cracked bells and snarling dogs filling the air. And this time, he dragged Morgan Sloat's son Richard with him. Interlude. Sloat in this world, Auris in the territories, 3. Shortly after 7 a.m., on the morning following Jack and Richard's flip out from Thayer, Morgan Sloat drew up to the curb just outside the main gates of Thayer School. He parked. The space was marked with a handicapped-only sign. Sloat glanced at it indifferently, then reached into his pocket, drew out a vial of cocaine, and used some of it. In a few moments, the world seemed to gain color and vitality. It was wonderful stuff. He wondered if it would grow in the territories, and if it would be more potent over there. Gardner himself had awakened Sloat in his Beverly Hills home at 2 a.m. to tell him what had happened. It had been midnight in Springfield. Gardner's voice had been trembling. He was obviously terrified that Morgan would fly into a rage and furious that he had missed Jack Sawyer by less than an hour. That boy! That bad, bad boy! Sloat had not flown into a rage. Indeed, he had felt extraordinarily calm. He felt a sense of predestination, which he suspected came from that other part of him, what he thought of as his Aurisness, in a half-understood pun on royalty. "Be calm," Sloat had soothed. "I'll be there as soon as I can. Hang in there, baby." He had broken the connection before Gardner could say any more and lain back on the bed. He had crossed his hands on his stomach and closed his eyes. There was a moment of weightlessness, just a moment, and then he felt a sensation of movement beneath him. He heard the creak of leather traces, the groan and thump of rough iron springs, the curses of his driver. He had opened his eyes as Morgan of Auris. As always, his first reaction was pure delight. This made coke seem like baby aspirin. His chest was narrower, his weight less. Morgan Sloat's heartbeat ran anywhere from 85 beats a minute to 120 when he was pissed off. Auris's rarely went higher than 65 or so. Morgan Sloat's eyesight was tested at 20/20, but Morgan of Auris nonetheless saw better. He could see and trace the course of every minute crack in the sidewall of the diligence, could marvel over the fineness of the mesh curtains which blew through the windows. Cocaine had clogged Sloat's nose, dulling his sense of smell. Auris's nose was totally clear, and he could smell dust and earth and air with perfect fidelity. It was as if he could sense and appreciate every molecule. Behind him, he had left an empty double bed still marked with the shape of his large body. Here he was sitting on a bench seat, plusher than the seat in any Rolls-Royce ever made, riding west toward the end of the outposts, toward a place which was called Outpost Depot, toward a man named Anders. He knew these things, knew exactly where he was, because Auris was still here, inside his head, speaking to him the way the right side of the brain may speak to the rational left during daydreams, in a low but perfectly clear voice. Sloat had spoken to Auris in this same low undervoice on the few occasions when Auris had migrated to what Jack had come to think of as the American territories. When one migrated and entered the body of one's twinner, the result was a kind of benign possession. Sloat had read of more violent cases of possession, and although the subject did not greatly interest him, he guessed that the poor, unlucky slob so afflicted had been taken over by mad hitchhikers from other worlds. Or perhaps it was the American world itself which had driven them mad. That seemed more than possible. It had certainly done a number on poor old Auris's head the first 2 or 3 times he had popped over, although he had been wildly excited as well as terrified. The diligence took a mighty bounce. In the outposts, you took the roads as you found them and thanked God they were there at all.
Oris shifted in his seat, and his club foot muttered dull pain.
"Hold on steady, God pound you," the driver muttered up above. His whip whistled and popped. "Roll, you sons of dead horrors, roll on!"
Sloat grinned with the pleasure of being here, even though it would only be for moments. He already knew what he needed to know. Oris's voice had muttered it to him. The diligence would arrive at Outpost Depot, Thayer School in the other world, well before morning. It might be possible to take them there if they had lingered. If not, the blasted lands awaited them. It hurt and enraged him to think that Richard was now with the Sawyer brat, but if a sacrifice was demanded, well, Oris had lost his son and survived. The only thing that had kept Jack alive this long was the maddening fact of his single nature. When the whelp flipped to a place, he was always in the analog of the place he had left. Sloat, however, always ended up where Oris was, which might be miles away from where he needed to be, as was the case now. He had been lucky at the rest area, but Sawyer had been luckier.
"Your luck will run out soon enough, my little friend," Oris said.
The diligence took another terrific bounce. He grimaced, then grinned. If nothing else, the situation was simplifying itself, even as the final confrontation took on wider and deeper implications. Enough. He closed his eyes and crossed his arms. For just a moment he felt another dull thud of pain in the deformed foot, and when he opened his eyes, Sloat was looking up at the ceiling of his apartment. As always, there was a moment when the extra pounds fell into him with sickening weight, when his heart reacted with a surprised double beat, and then sped up. He had gotten to his feet then and had called West Coast Business Jet. 70 minutes later, he had been leaving LAX. The Lear's steep and abrupt takeoff stance made him feel as it always did. It was as if a blowtorch had been strapped to his ass. They had touched down in Springfield at 5:50 Central Time, just as Oris would be approaching Outpost Depot in the Territories. Sloat had rented a Hertz sedan, and here he was. American travel did have its advantages. He got out of the car, and just as the morning bells began to ring, he walked onto the Thayer campus his own son had so lately quitted. Everything was the essence of an early Thayer weekday morning. The chapel bells were playing a normal morning tune, something classical but not quite recognizable, which sounded a bit like Te Deum but wasn't. Students passed Sloat on their way to the dining hall or to morning workouts. They were perhaps a little more silent than usual, and they shared a look, pale and slightly dazed, as if they had all shared a disquieting dream. Which, of course, they had, Sloat thought. He stopped for a moment in front of Nelson House, looking at it thoughtfully. They simply didn't know how fundamentally unreal they all were, as all creatures who live near the thin places between worlds must be. He walked around to the side and watched a maintenance man picking up broken glass that lay on the ground like trumpery diamonds. Beyond his bent back, Sloat could see into the Nelson House lounge, where an unusually quiet Albert the Blob was sitting and looking blankly at a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Sloat started across toward the depot, his thoughts turning to the first time that Oris had flipped over into this world. He found himself thinking of that time with a nostalgia that was, when one really stopped to think about it, damn near grotesque. After all, he had nearly died. Both of them had nearly died. But it had been in the middle 50s, and now he was in his middle 50s. It made all the difference in the world. He had been coming back from the office, and the sun had been going down in a Los Angeles haze of smudged purples and smoky yellows. This had been in the days before the L.A. smog had really begun to thicken up. He had been on Sunset Boulevard and looking at a billboard advertising a new Peggy Lee record when he had felt a coldness in his mind. It had been as if a wellspring had suddenly opened somewhere in his subconscious, spilling out some alien weirdness that was like semen. Well, he didn't know exactly what it had been like, except that it had quickly become warm, gained cognizance, and he had just had time to realize that it was he, Oris,
And then everything had turned topsy-turvy, like a secret door on its gimbal, a bookcase on one side, a Chippendale dresser on the other, both fitting the ambience of the room perfectly. And it had been Oris sitting behind the wheel of a 1952 bullet-nosed Ford. Oris wearing the brown double-breasted suit and the John Penske tie. Oris who was reaching down toward his crotch, not in pain, but in slightly disgusted curiosity. Oris who had, of course, never worn undershorts. There had been a moment, he remembered, when the Ford had nearly driven up onto the sidewalk, and then Morgan Sloat, now very much the undermined, had taken over that part of the operation, and Oris had been free to go along his way, goggling at everything, nearly half-mad with delight. And what remained of Morgan Sloat had also been delighted. He had been delighted the way a man is delighted when he shows a friend around his new home for the first time and finds that his friend likes it as much as he likes it himself. Oris had cruised into a Fat Boy drive-in, and after some fumbling with Morgan's unfamiliar paper money, he had ordered a hamburger and French fries and a chocolate thick shake, the words coming easily out of his mouth, welling up from that undermined as water wells up from a spring. Oris's first bite of the hamburger had been tentative, and then he had gobbled the rest with the speed of wolf gobbling his first whopper. He had crammed the fries into his mouth with one hand while dialing the radio with the other, picking up an enticing babble of pop and Perry Como and some big band and early rhythm and blues. He had sucked down the shake and then had ordered more of everything. Halfway through the second burger, he, Sloat, as well as Oris, began to feel sick. Suddenly the fried onions had seemed too strong, too cloying. Suddenly the smell of car exhaust was everywhere. His arms had suddenly begun to itch madly. He pulled off the coat of the double-breasted suit. The second thick shake, this one mocha, fell unheeded to one side, dribbling ice cream across the Ford seat, and looked at his arms. Ugly red blotches with red centers were growing there and spreading. His stomach lurched, he leaned out the window, and even as he puked into the tray that was fixed there, he had felt Oris fleeing from him, going back into his own world. "Can I help you, sir?" "Hm?" Startled out of his reverie, Sloat looked around. A tall blonde boy, obviously an upperclassman, was standing there. He was dressed prep, an impeccable blue flannel blazer worn over an open-collared shirt and a pair of faded Levi's. He brushed hair out of his eyes, which had that same dazed, dreaming look. "I'm Etheridge, sir. I just wondered if I could help you. You looked lost." Sloat smiled. He thought of saying, but did not, "No, that's how you look, my friend." Everything was all right. The Sawyer brat was still on the loose, but Sloat knew where he was going, and that meant that Jackie was on a chain. It was invisible, but it was still a chain. "Lost in the past, that's all," he said. "Old times. I'm not a stranger here, Mr. Etheridge, if that's what you're worried about. My son's a student, Richard Sloat." Etheridge's eyes grew even dreamier for a moment, puzzled, lost. Then they cleared. "Sure, Richard," he exclaimed. "I'll be going up to see the headmaster in a bit. I just wanted to have a poke around first." "Well, I guess that's fine." Etheridge looked at his watch. "I have table duty this morning, so if you're sure you're okay..."
"I'm sure."
Etheridge gave him a nod, a rather vague smile, and started off. Sloat watched him go, and then he surveyed the ground between Nelson House and here, noted the broken window again. A straight shot. It was fair, more than fair, to assume that somewhere between Nelson House and this octagonal brick building, the two boys had migrated into the territories. If he liked, he could follow them. Just step inside, there was no lock on the door, and disappear. Reappear wherever Oris's body happened to be at this moment. It would be somewhere close, perhaps even, in fact, in front of the depot keeper himself. No nonsense about migrating to a spot which might be 100 miles away from the point of interest in territory's geography, and no way to cover the intervening distance but by wagon, or worse, what his father had called Shank's mare. The boys would already have gone on, in all likelihood, into the blasted lands. If so, the blasted lands would finish them. And Sunlight Gardener's twinner, Osmond, would be more than capable of squeezing out all the information that Anders knew.
Osmond and his horrid son. No need to migrate at all. Except maybe for a look-see, for the pleasure and refreshment of becoming Oris again, if only for a few seconds. And to make sure, of course. His entire life, from childhood onward, had been an exercise in making sure. He looked around once, to assure himself that Etheridge had not lingered. Then he opened the door of the depot and went inside. The smell was stale, dark, and incredibly nostalgic. The smell of old makeup and canvas flats. For a moment, he had the crazy idea that he had done something even more incredible than migrating. He felt that he might have traveled back through time to those undergraduate days when he and Phil Sawyer had been theater-mad college students. Then his eyes adjusted to the dimness, and he saw the unfamiliar, almost mawkish props. A plaster bust of Pallas for a production of The Raven, an extravagantly gilt birdcage, a bookcase full of false bindings, and remembered that he was in the Thayer School excuse for a little theater. He paused for a moment, breathing deeply of the dust. He turned his eyes up to one dusty sunray falling through a small window. The light wavered and was suddenly a deeper gold, the color of lamplight. He was in the territories. Just like that, he was in the territories. There was a moment of almost staggering exhilaration at the speed of the change. Usually there was a pause, a sense of side-slipping from one place to another. This caesura seemed to be in direct proportion to the distance between the physical bodies of his two selves, Sloat and Oris. Once, when he had migrated from Japan, where he was negotiating a deal with the Shaw brothers for a terrible novel about Hollywood stars menaced by a crazed ninja, the pause had gone on so long that he feared he might be lost forever somewhere in the empty, senseless purgatory that exists between the worlds. But this time they had been close, so close. It was like those few times, he thought, Oris thought, when a man and woman achieve orgasm at the exact same instant and die in sex together. The smell of dried paint and canvas was replaced with the light, pleasant smell of territory's burning oil. The lamp on the table was guttering low, sending out dark membranes of smoke. To his left a table was set, the remains of a meal congealing on the rough plates. Three plates. Oris stepped forward, dragging his club foot a little, as always. He tipped one of the plates up, let the guttering lamplight skate queasily across the grease. Who ate from this one? Was it Anders, or Jason, or Richard? The boy would also have been Rushton if my son had lived. Rushton had drowned while swimming in a pond not far from the great house. There had been a picnic. Oris and his wife had drunk a quantity of wine. The sun had been hot. The boy, little more than an infant, had been napping. Oris and his wife had made love, and then they had also fallen asleep in the sweet afternoon sunshine. He had been awakened by the child's cries. Rushton had awakened and gone down to the water. He had been able to dog paddle a little, just enough to get well out beyond his depth before panicking. Oris had limped to the water, dived in, and swum as fast as he could out to where the boy floundered. It was his foot, his damned foot, that had hampered him and perhaps cost his son his life. When he reached the boy, he had been sinking. Oris had managed to catch him by the hair and pull him to shore, but by then Rushton had been blue and dead. Margaret had died by her own hand less than 6 weeks later. 7 months after that, Morgan Sloat's own young son had nearly drowned in a Westwood YMCA pool during a young paddler's class. He had been pulled from the pool as blue and dead as Rushton, but the lifeguard had applied mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and Richard Sloat had responded. God pounds his nails, Oris thought, and then a deep, blurry snore snapped his head around. Anders, the depot keeper, lay on a pallet in the corner with his kilt rudely pulled up to his breeks. An earthen jug of wine lay overturned nearby. Much of the wine had flowed into his hair. He snored again, then moaned, as if with bad dreams. No dream you might have could be as bad as your future now is, Oris thought grimly.
He took a step closer, his cloak flapping around him. He looked down on Anders with no pity. Sloat was able to plan murder, but it had been Oris, time and time again, who had migrated to carry out the act itself. It had been Oris in Sloat's body who had attempted to smother the infant Jack Sawyer with a pillow while a wrestling announcer droned on and on in the background. Oris, who had overseen the assassination of Phil Sawyer in Utah, just as he had overseen the assassination of Phil Sawyer's counterpart, the commoner Prince Philip Sawtell in the territories. Sloat had a taste for blood, but ultimately he was as allergic to it as Oris was to American food and American air. It was Morgan of Oris, once derided as Morgan Thudfoot, who had always done the deeds Sloat had planned. "My son died. His still lives. Sawtell's son died. Sawyer's still lives. But these things can be remedied, will be remedied. No talisman for you, my sweet little friends. You are bound for a radioactive version of Oatley, and you each owe the balance scales a death. God pounds his nails." "And if God doesn't, you may be sure I will," he said aloud. The man on the floor moaned again as if he had heard. Oris took another step toward him, perhaps meaning to kick him awake, and then cocked his head. In the distance he heard hoofbeats, the faint creak and jingle of harness, the hoarse cries of drovers. That would be Osman, then. Good. Let Osman take care of business here. He himself had little interest in questioning a man with a hangover when he knew well enough what the man would have to say. Oris clumped across to the door, opened it, and looked out on a gorgeous peach-colored territory sunrise. It was from this direction, the direction of the sunrise, that the sounds of approaching riders came. He allowed himself to drink in that lovely glow for a moment, and then turned toward the west again, where the sky was still the color of a fresh bruise. The land was dark, except for where the first sunlight bounced off a pair of bright, parallel lines. "Boys, you have gone to your deaths," Oris thought with satisfaction. And then a thought occurred, which brought even more satisfaction. Their deaths might already have happened. "Good," Oris said, and closed his eyes. A moment later, Morgan Sloat was gripping the handle of the door of Thayer School's little theater, opening his own eyes, and planning his trip back to the West Coast. It might be time to take a little trip down memory lane, he thought, to a town in California called Point Venuti. A trip back east first, perhaps a visit to the Queen, and then... "The sea air," he said to the bust of Pallas, "will do me good." He ducked back inside, had another jolt from the small vial in his pocket, hardly noticing the smells of canvas and makeup now. And, thus refreshed, he started back downhill toward his car. Part 4. The Talisman. Chapter 34. Anders. Jack suddenly realized that although he was still running, he was running on thin air, like a cartoon character who has time for one surprise double take before plunging 2,000 feet straight down. But it wasn't 2,000 feet. He had time, just, to realize that the ground wasn't there anymore, and then he dropped 4 or 5 feet still running. He wobbled and might have remained upright, but then Richard came piling into him and they both went tumbling.
"Look out, Jack!"
Richard was screaming. He was apparently not interested in taking his own advice, because his eyes were squeezed tightly shut.
"Look out for the wolf! Look out for Mr. Duffery! Look out! Stop it, Richard!"
These breathless screams frightened him more than anything else had done. Richard sounded mad, absolutely mad.
"Stop it! We're all right! They're gone!" "Look out for Etheridge! Look out for the bugs! Look out, Jack!
Richard, they're gone! Look around you for Jason's sake!" Jack hadn't had a chance to do this himself, but he knew they had made it. The air was still and sweet, the night perfectly silent, except for a slim breeze that was blessedly warm.
Look out, Jack! Look out, Jack! Look out! Look out!
Like a bad echo inside his head, he heard a memory of the dog boys outside Nelson House chorusing, "Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Please, please, please!"
Look out, Jack!
Richard wailed. His face was slammed into the earth, and he looked like an overenthusiastic Muslim, determined to get in good with Allah.
Look out, the wolf! Prefects! The headmaster! Look out!
Panicked by the idea that Richard actually had gone crazy, Jack yanked his friend's head up by the back of his collar and slapped his face. Richard's words were cut cleanly off. He gaped at Jack, and Jack saw the shape of his own hand rising on Richard's pale cheek, a dim red tattoo. His shame was replaced by an urgent curiosity to know just where they were. There was light, otherwise he wouldn't have been able to see that mark. A partial answer to the question came from inside him. It was certain and unquestionable, at least as far as it went. The outposts, Jacko. You're in the outposts now. But before he could spend any time mulling that over, he had to try to get Richard shipshape. Are you all right, Richie? He was looking at Jack with numb, hurt surprise.
You hit me, Jack.
I slapped you. That's what you're supposed to do with hysterical people.
I wasn't hysterical. I've never been hysterical in my...
Richard broke off and jumped to his feet, looking around wildly.
The wolf! We have to look out for the wolf, Jack. If we can get over the fence, he won't be able to get us.
He would have gone sprinting off into the darkness right then, making for a cyclone fence which was now in another world, if Jack hadn't grabbed him and held him back.
The wolf is gone, Richard.
Huh?
We made it.
What are you talking about?
The territories, Richard. We're in the territories. We flipped over,
and you almost pulled my damn arm out of its socket, you unbeliever, Jack thought, rubbing his throbbing shoulder. The next time I try to haul someone across, I'm going to find myself a real little kid, one who still believes in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny.
That's ridiculous, Richard said slowly. There's no such thing as the territories, Jack.
If there isn't, Jack said grimly, then how come that great big white wolf isn't biting your ass or your own damn headmaster? Richard looked at Jack, opened his mouth to say something, then closed it again. He looked around, this time with a bit more attention, at least Jack hoped so. Jack did the same, enjoying the warmth and the clarity of the air as he did so. Morgan and his crowd of snake pit crazies might come bursting through at any second, but for now it was impossible not to luxuriate in the pure animal joy of being back here again. They were in a field. High, yellowish grass with bearded heads, not wheat, but something like wheat, some edible grain anyway, stretched off into the night in every direction. The warm breeze rippled it in mysterious but rather lovely waves. To the right was a wooden building standing on a slight knoll, a lamp mounted on a pole in front of it. A yellow flame, almost too bright to look at, burned clearly inside the lamp's glass globe. Jack saw that the building was octagonal. The two boys had come into the territories on the outermost edge of the circle of light that lamp threw, and there was something on the far side of the circle, something metallic, that threw back the lamplight in broken glimmers. Jack squinted at the faint, silvery glow, and then understood. What he felt was not so much wonder as a sense of fulfilled expectation. It was as if two very large jigsaw puzzle pieces, one in the American territories and one over here, had just come neatly together. Those were railroad tracks. And although it was impossible to tell direction in the darkness, Jack thought he knew in which direction those tracks would travel. West.
Come on, Jack said.
I don't want to go up there, Richard said.
Why not?
Too much crazy stuff going on. Richard wet his lips.
Could be anything up there in that building. Dogs, crazy people.
He wet his lips again.
Bugs.
I told you we're in the territories now. The craziness has all blown away. It's clean here.
Hell, Richard, can't you smell it?
There are no such things as territories, Richard said thinly.
Look around you.
No, Richard said.
His voice was thinner than ever, the voice of an infuriatingly stubborn child. Jack snatched up a handful of the heavily bearded grass.
Look at this!
Richard turned his head. Jack had to actively restrain an urge to shake him. Instead of doing that, he tossed the grass away, counted mentally to 10, and then started up the hill. He looked down and saw that he was now wearing something like leather chaps. Richard was dressed in much the same way, and he had a red bandana around his neck that looked like something out of a Frederick Remington painting. Jack reached up to his own neck and felt a similar bandana. He ran his hands down along his body and discovered that Miles P. Kiger's wonderfully warm coat was now something very like a Mexican serape. I bet I look like an advertisement for Taco Bell, he thought, and grinned. An expression of utter panic came over Richard's face when Jack started up the hill, leaving him alone at the bottom.
Where are you going?
Jack looked at Richard and came back. He put his hands on Richard's shoulders and looked soberly into Richard's eyes. We can't stay here, he said. Some of them must have seen us flip. It may be that they can't come right after us, or it may be that they can. I don't know. I know as much about the laws governing all of this as a kid of 5 knows about magnetism. And all a kid of 5 knows on the subject is that sometimes magnets attract and sometimes they repel. But for the time being, that's all I have to know. We have to get out of here. End of story.
I'm dreaming all this. I know I am.
Jack nodded toward the ramshackle wooden building. You can come or you can stay here. If you want to stay here, I'll come back for you after I check the place out.
None of this is happening, Richard said.
His naked, glassesless eyes were wide and flat and somehow dusty. He looked for a moment up at the black territory sky with its strange and unfamiliar sprawl of stars, shuddered, and looked away.
I have a fever. It's the flu. There's been a lot of flu around. This is a delirium. You're guest starring in my delirium, Jack.
Well, I'll send somebody around to the Delirium Actors Guild with my aftercard when I get a chance, Jack said. In the meantime, why don't you just stay here, Richard? If none of this is happening, then you have nothing to worry about. He started away again, thinking that it would take only a few more of these Alice at the Tea Party conversations with Richard to convince him that he was crazy as well. He was halfway up the hill when Richard joined him. I would have come back for you, Jack said.
I know, Richard said. I just thought that I might as well come along, as long as all of this is a dream anyway.
Well, keep your mouth shut if there's anyone up there, Jack said. I think there is. I think I saw someone looking out that front window at me.
What are you going to do? Richard asked.
Jack smiled. Play it by ear, Richie boy, he said. That's what I've been doing ever since I left New Hampshire. Playing it by ear. They reached the porch. Richard clutched Jack's shoulder with panicky strength. Jack turned toward him wearily. Richard's patented Kansas City clutch was something else that was getting old in a big hurry.
What? Jack asked. This is a dream, all right, Richard said, and I can prove it.
How?
We're not talking English anymore, Jack. We're talking some language, and we're speaking it perfectly, but it's not English.
Yeah, Jack said. Weird, isn't it? He started up the steps again, leaving Richard standing below him, gape-mouthed. After a moment or two, Richard recovered and scrambled up the steps after Jack. The boards were warped and loose and splintery. Stalks of that richly bearded grain grass grew up through some of them. Off in the deep darkness, both boys could hear the sleepy hum of insects. It was not the reedy scratch of crickets, but a sweeter sound. So much was sweeter over here, Jack thought. The outside lamp was now behind them. Their shadows ran ahead of them across the porch and then made right angles to climb the door. There was an old, faded sign on that door. For a moment it seemed to Jack to be written in strange Cyrillic letters, as indecipherable as Russian. Then they came clear, and the word was no surprise, Depot. Jack raised his hand to knock, then shook his head a little. No, he would not knock. This was not a private dwelling. The sign said Depot,
and that was a word he associated with public buildings, places to wait for Greyhound buses and Amtrak trains, loading zones for the friendly skies. He pushed the door open. Friendly lamplight and a decidedly unfriendly voice came out onto the porch together.
"Get away, you devil!"
the cracked voice screeched.
"Get away! I'm going in the morning, I swear! The train's in the shed, go away! I swore I'd go, and I will go, so now ye go! Go and leave me some peace!"
Jack frowned. Richard gaped. The room was clean, but very old. The boards were so warped that the walls seemed almost to ripple. A picture of a stagecoach, which looked almost as big as a whaling ship, hung on one wall. An ancient counter, its flat surface almost as ripply as the walls, ran across the middle of the room, splitting it in two. Behind it, on the far wall, was a slate board with stage arrives written above one column and stage leaves written above the other. Looking at the ancient board, Jack guessed it had been a good long time since any information had been written there. He thought that if someone tried to write on it with even a piece of soft chalk, the slate would crack in pieces and fall to the weathered floor. Standing on one side of the counter was the biggest hourglass Jack had ever seen. It was as big as a magnum of champagne and filled with green sand.
"Leave me alone, can't ya? I've promised ye I'd go, and I will. Please, Morgan, for your mercy, I've promised. And if you don't believe me, look in the shed. The train is ready. I swear the train is ready."
There was a good deal more gabble and gobble in this same vein. The large, elderly man spouting it was cringing in the far right-hand corner of the room. Jack guessed the oldster's height at 6'3" at least, even in his present servile posture. The depot's low ceiling was only 4 inches or so above his head. He might have been 70, he might have been a fairly well-preserved 80. A snowy white beard began under his eyes and cascaded down over his breast in a spray of baby-fine hair. His shoulders were broad, although now so slumped that they looked as if someone had broken them by forcing him to carry heavy weights over the course of many long years. Deep crow's feet radiated out from the corners of his eyes. Deep fissures undulated on his forehead. His complexion was waxy yellow. He was wearing a white kilt shot through with bright scarlet threads, and he was obviously scared almost to death. He was brandishing a stout staff, but with no authority at all. Jack glanced sharply around at Richard when the old man mentioned the name of Richard's father, but Richard was currently beyond noticing such fine points. "I am not who you think I am," Jack said, advancing toward the old man.
"Get away!"
he shrieked.
"None of your guff! I guess the devil can put on a pleasing face. Get away! I'll do it! She's ready to go, first thing in the morning. I said I'd do it, and I mean to. Now get away, can't ya?"
The knapsack was now a haversack hanging from Jack's arm. As Jack reached the counter, he rummaged in it, pushing aside the mirror and a number of the jointed money sticks. His fingers closed around what he wanted, and he brought it out. It was the coin Captain Farron had given him so long ago, the coin with the queen on one side and the griffin on the other. He slammed it down on the counter, and the room's mellow light caught the lovely profile of Laura Deloessian. Again, he was struck with wonder by the similarity of that profile to the profile of his mother. Did they look that much alike at the beginning? Is it just that I see the similarities more as I think about them more? Or am I actually bringing them together somehow? Making them one? The old man cringed back even farther as Jack came forward to the counter. It began to seem as though he might push himself right through the back of the building. His words began to pour out in a hysterical flood. When Jack slammed the coin down on the counter like a bad man in a Western movie demanding a drink, he suddenly stopped talking. He stared at the coin, his eyes widening, the spit-shiny corners of his mouth twitching. His widening eyes rose to Jack's face and really saw him for the first time.